Hello and welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack
and Sean Chapman.
We are here to talk about stuff this week on the show. We have a whole bunch of stuff to talk about because it is that time of the year where we are being buried alive in video games. Among others, we will be talking about Red Dead Redemption 2 in spoiler detail for the first time, Hitman 2 in less spoilery detail, although I'm not sure what you spoil about. It's a different kind of game.
Yeah.
Pokemon Let's Go, which is really good. More Dragon Ball FighterZ, which we've been talking about on and off all year because, you know, Dragon Ball is life. We're also going to be talking about Jonathan's adventures with Dragon Ball Super, which he is finally catching up on, as well as a bunch of news, including topics such as what a shit show the PlayStation Classic is, and Netflix doing both good and bad things with its money. So, that will be our topics for today. We are not going to be talking about Doctor Who today because we missed last week's episode because we pre-recorded. I have had the time to catch up on Doctor Who if I really wanted to, but I would have had to tear myself away from where I'm at in Dragon Ball Super, and I'm not doing that because Doctor Who is in its, like, lowest ebb ever right now, and Dragon Ball Super, where I'm at, is at, like, its highest ebb for that particular incarnation of Dragon Ball, so it's just not going to happen. Is that fair, Sean?
Yeah, that's fair. I have watched the two most recent episodes of Doctor Who, The Witchfinders and It Takes You Away, It Takes You Away being the penultimate episode of this season, which I had to be reminded of after the end of that episode because it is, I don't know what a season finale is for this season of Doctor Who now. But yeah, Doctor Who, we're not going to do reviews of those episodes.
Were they okay?
They're both okay. They're both two of the better episodes this season, and they're very different episodes. The Witchfinders is a totally passable RTD style historical that is only elevated by Alan Cumming playing King James, and he is very funny.
Has Alan Cumming not been on Doctor Who yet?
It's a good question. I don't know. Yeah. I think it's because of, like, I don't know why for modern Doctor Who, but, you know, it's that he, like, kind of came up in the wilderness years, I feel like, so...
Modern Doctor Who is 13 years true. Now, so...
It's very true. There's been more than enough opportunity. But yeah, if it was not for his performance, it would be like a totally, I mean, it would be still one of the better episodes for this season, but it would be otherwise a totally just average, like I was thinking after I watched it, like it's maybe a little bit better than like A Curse of the Black Spot. It's like one of those.
Okay.
It feels like one of those. And then It Takes You Away is an interesting one. I think it's going to be an episode that's kind of divisive because it is very weird. And I think there are going to be, and I've already seen some people really like it just because it gets really weird in the end. But I think like most things in this season, the weirdness isn't used for anything substantive. You know, it's not weird in the way that like Douglas Adams, who could be weird, or Stephen Moffat, who can be weird, because those weirdnesses are used in to like deliver a compelling aesthetic point and a compelling thematic point and to deliver some sort of high concept exploration of something like an extremist or something from last season. This episode goes to weird places, but it doesn't use that weirdness to really explore much of anything in the story. And it feels like a very disjointed episode that has kind of three different, like the three acts of the episodes feel like it is three acts from three totally different episodes that just got stitched together. So it's ends up being what is, what again, one of the better episodes of the season, because it's not written by Chris Chibnall, but it is, neither of them are, like, stellar or are going to, like, change your opinion on the season. They're more just like, okay, this is, like, a vaguely acceptable level of quality for Doctor Who to be at like, its minimum. You know, that's kind of where I'm at with it.
Well, that's a real stellar review there, Sean. For it's at what it needs to be at for its minimum.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, before we move on, I just want to bring up one more thing, because we know we're not going to get to Doctor Who later. Because there's just one thing about it that is blowing my mind, which is I'm going to spoil this one feature of these two episodes, Jonathan, because it's a non-feature. So next week we are getting the Battle of Ranskor Avkalos, which is the name of the finale. Maybe the worst name.
I guarantee you. That is the most thought Chris Chibnall will have put into that episode.
Yeah.
That stupid title.
It is maybe the worst title for any episode of Doctor Who ever. It's just utter fucking garbage nonsense. So next week, the Battle of Ranskor Avkalos is going to be the finale of this 10-episode long season. And you remember, Jonathan, that in the first episode, we had that adventure with the Stenza. And then in the second episode, the Stenza are brought up again as, like, a pivotal part in the plot of that episode that, like, they destroyed the planet that they're on and created it. That's why all these, like, evil scarves and shit exist. And then past that point, the Stenza or anything like that was never brought up again. And now, and presumably at that point, we were like, oh, the Stenza must be the week, like, or like the season-long villain. That's going to be like, the finale is going to deal with that shit. And then since that point, they have not brought it up. And now I can say, having seen episode 8 and 9, they never bring it up again.
Well, of course they don't. There's nothing going on this season, Sean. I'm so dead inside about this. Like, you're acting like you're surprised that there's no substance in the substance-free season of Doctor Who.
But I just feel like... if it was only the first episode, fine. Like, I don't give a shit. Cause then it's all completely standalone and it's bad because there's no real character arcs to be resolved or anything like that. But whatever. Like, if they're all just completely independent episodes, it's like a weird procedural show. Okay. Like, I can accept that. But when you do it in the first episode and then you bring it up again totally unnecessarily in the second episode and drag part of that episode down because you have to explain all this bullshit that honestly just drags the focus away, what should have been the focus of that episode, which is the whole weird race thing. Not the weird race thing in Rosa, the weird race thing in the Ghost Monument. Two different race things. But it drags that whole episode down. And so you would expect that at least at like the end of episode 9, there would be a like, something like a, oh, we need to do this thing. There's a message with the TARDIS. You pick like to tease... Next time, season finale of season 11 of Doctor Who, the first season with Jodie Whittaker. Like, you'd expect some sort of drama going into the season finale of a modern TV show, and there's nothing. Like, every episode between the fucking Ghost Monument and now could have been put in literally any order, and it would make no difference because there's no meaningful continuity between any episodes, even among the characters. There's a little bit in It Takes You Away at the very end, but other than that, and that's just with like a little bit of character stuff between Graham and Ryan, because presumably Chris Chibnall didn't want to have the like meager conclusion to those two characters' story arcs in his last episode, so they kind of resolved their thing in this episode. And other than that, it's just nothing. And it just blows my mind that we are here at the cusp of the end of this season of Doctor Who, Chris Chibnall's first season, and even if you're someone who somehow liked a lot of these episodes, I don't know how you could have any enthusiasm going into the finale at all, because there's no enthusiasm, no even attempt to generate enthusiasm. It just doesn't even feel like they care to try to see, like, hey, this season's going to be over, and then we're going to presumably make another one, but hey, this is going to, like, wrap up what this arc is for this part of the show. It's so bizarre to me.
You would indeed expect that a show that has been running 55 years, has one of the most prestigious reputations in the history of television, would have baseline competence in its writing. But that's not what happened this year.
Yep.
At all. So, yeah. Okay, we're going to be on a Doctor Who kick for just another minute or two. I promise we'll move on. Check the time code if you want to skip ahead. I've got a fun listener thing we're going to do in a second. But, Sean, I was really wondering if we were ever going to address this on the podcast, but just you kind of hinted at it there. Do you believe the rumors that Chris Chibnall and Jodie Whittaker are leaving?
No, not really.
I don't, but at the same time, so if you didn't follow, the British tabloids do this all the time with Doctor Who, and normally I don't pay them a lick of attention, but there was a tabloid report a couple weeks ago that Chris Chibnall and Jodie Whittaker are planning to leave next year after an abbreviated second season together, and it looked like the absolute kind of nonsense that you normally get in the tabloids about Doctor Who, but there was one line that just felt like, if true, it would so line up with everything that's happened this season, which was apparently Chris Chibnall is complaining about having to make too many episodes, and that's their big source of tension. And I don't know, it would just be kind of perfect if the resolution to this weird period in Doctor Who is that somebody came in who had no ability to write Doctor Who, apparently no interest in getting better at it, wrote fewer episodes than literally any of his predecessors in the 55-year history of the show have done for a season, and then left because it was too much work.
Yeah.
And that would be that was the only thing that sounded weirdly in character, because frankly, the most meaningful change other than the lobotomization of the show that happened this year is going down three episodes, you know, like, and just having nothing. So I don't believe it. Doctor Who rumors are almost never accurate. You know, you will remember that Jodie Whittaker was predicted to be the Doctor by exactly zero tabloids in the lead up to, until I think the night before it leaked. But until then, it was, everyone thought it was going to be some weird British fuckboy whose name I don't remember. So I would not put any faith in that report. Just that one line in it made me laugh heartily. So we'll see.
Yeah. No, I'm just sitting here thinking about how, fuck, we have one more episode of Chris Chibnall Doctor Who next week because he's writing the finale. And I just remembered that.
And then we get one at New Year's, Sean.
Fucking shit. Because it's like the only vaguely redeemable part of this whole season was this last stretch of like four episodes or whatever where they weren't written by him. Because even when you had like morally objectionable shit like Kerblam, at least it was dramatically sound as a script in some ways. It wasn't utterly inept like all the way through. And we're getting two more Chris Chibnall episodes of Doctor Who soon. So yay.
Yeah. All right. Well, anyway, let's go ahead and move on, Sean. That was our little talk. We will talk more Doctor Who next week, obviously. I think we're going to do a final discussion about the season after the finale, and I don't know how much we'll even get into the last two episodes. It sounds like there might be some points of interest, but...
I can say there's almost nothing to talk about with the Witchfinders. That least It Takes You Away is an episode that I want to talk to you about. Like, that's... Okay. And not necessarily in just like a totally negative way. I think there's fun things to say about that episode.
Good.
The Witchfinders is pretty disposable.
I will look forward to that one. All right. I will look forward to that one. And other than that, I will look forward to Jodie Whittaker doing Big Finish audio dramas in 30 years.
Right. Yeah.
That's the next thing I'm looking forward to with the 13th Doctor. All right. Let's see. So, Sean, I have a little... I have not told you about this yet, although we've been talking about it a little bit off the air. But this is a request for both of us to be thinking about and listeners, which is that... Sean and I really want to, at some point, do another series of movies discussions. You'll remember that earlier this year we did 6 months where we did, once a month, we did the original Star Wars films, 1 through 6. And then we did the Spider-Man films in advance of the PlayStation 4 game. And since then, we have been buried alive under a pile of video games and unable to talk about movies really at all. We haven't been able to do it again, but we want to do it again. And I think we have so many options, the best thing would be to, like, open it up to listeners and put it to a vote. But to do that, we're going to have to narrow down our options, Sean. So, Sean, do you want to hear my short list of things I think we could do a rewatch project on?
Okay, sure.
And I will give you some. You will give me any that you want to add. We'll try to, like, whittle this down. And, you know, listeners, please feel free to tweet at me or Sean or email us or whatever. There's contact options on the website and everything if you would like to add something to this list. And then maybe in a week or two I'll open up a poll and we'll try to figure out what our listeners can help us decide what our first one will be in the new year when we have a little more time. But, Sean, I've got 8 that I thought of off the top of my head.
Okay. Shoot.
All right. I'm going from most serious to least serious with this, so just be aware of that. The Dark Knight trilogy, the Batman movies, that would be very in line with what we've done so far.
Yes, it's been long enough since Dark Knight Rises that I think there's stuff to talk about with those movies again.
There's meat on those bones.
Yeah.
All right. The Lord of the Rings trilogy. I don't know what new we have to say to it, but I want to watch Lord of the Rings again, Sean.
Yeah, it does feel like it's about time for a... I think the last time I watched through all those movies was like 4 years ago. So.
Yeah.
It's time.
All right. Okay. Let's see. Sticking with trilogies, I now have an art house option and then a semi-art house option. My art house option is Satyajit Ray's The Apu trilogy.
I have not seen those. I will watch those.
If we want to do the least listened to episodes of the Weekly Stuff podcast ever, we could do that.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah.
We'll see. Okay. We'll see if people want to listen to that.
Semi-art house option, Sergio Leone's Dollars trilogy.
Okay, that would be fun. Yeah.
That would be really fun. That would also be a like low-level listen to episode, but, you know, it'd be fun.
Hey, Red Dead came out.
That's very true. That's very true. It would relate to... That's a vote in the column of the Dollars trilogy, I think. Yeah, all right. Okay, this is... Now we're getting into more than three movies. All 8 Harry Potter films.
No.
You're vetoing that?
No, they were definitely not. We can maybe do a select number of Harry Potter movies, like 3 and then 5, 6, one of the sevens or something. I can't watch 1 and 2 again. Or 4.
Oh,
I don't
like
those movies.
We can't do the first 3 Harry Potter movies?
The first 2 are the worst.
What if the people vote for it? And no, the first 2 are not the worst, because Fantastic Beasts, The Crimes of Grindelwald.
Okay, well, those aren't Harry Potter movies. Those are Fantastic Beasts movies,
okay.
Jonathan.
I'll keep Harry Potter movies with a question mark.
Okay, yeah, put a question mark on it. That's fine.
I don't know if it'll make it to the final round of voting, because Sean might veto it. All right. All the Muppet movies.
Okay, sure. I don't even know how many Muppet movies there are.
We would not be doing all of them. We would be skipping, like, the TV movies and stuff. I think there's probably, like, 5 or 6.
Yeah, I don't know if that would... Because I don't have, like, a huge Muppets thing. Like, I enjoyed the Muppets, but
okay.
I don't know if I have a huge amount to say about Muppets.
I'm actually going to switch that up to original Muppets trilogy, because I think the trilogy thing works better, and that would be the Muppet movie, The Muppets Take Manhattan, and The Great Muppet Caper.
Okay.
All right. Okay, now we're getting silly. All 26 Zatoichi movies.
That was going to be my recommendation for one we could do if you didn't put it on there.
Okay.
Alternatively,
I'm not sure how
we could do a selection of Zatoichi movies since continuity does not exist in Zatoichi. I think that is a serious...
That is a serious one.
I'm going to
love
you that is a
Zatoichi
serious
movies
thing.
Or fewer. But we're gonna leave that on there. Or fuck it, Sean, maybe we just do it as 9 episodes because there's 9 discs in the box set.
Talk about 3 movies on each episode? That would be pretty difficult.
Yeah, we could try it. All right. Let's see. Or finally, in the spirit of Dragon Ball being a thing again, a complete rewatch of all 64 episodes of Dragon Ball GT.
Oh, that's not where I thought you were going to go with that. That's another hard veto from me.
Okay.
Only about 2 or 3 years ago, I tried to watch through Dragon Ball GT, and I couldn't. I stopped.
I knew that was going to be your answer. It was there for fun. All right. Anything else you would add to that list as fun rewatch possibilities?
I mean, Zatoichi was the one I was thinking of because I did recently watch, I broke open my box set and watched 2 Zatoichi movies. I watched Zatoichi and the Doomed Man and Zatoichi and the Chess Expert, both of which very good movies. If we did a select rewatch, I would pick one of those to watch.
Okay. Awesome.
But yeah, I think that's a good list.
All right. Let's see. Are there any, I'm going to take the Apu trilogy off, even though those are probably the best movies on that list. I'm just going to take them off because that's not what our podcast is. We are not the weekly art house podcast.
Yeah.
We can start that as a spinoff at some point. But anyway, so let's see. This is down to 6 options. I'll leave it at this for now and hear if listeners have anything. And at some point, Sean, you and I will put our heads together and whittle this down to our favorite options and put it up to a vote online so you guys can help us decide.
And doing one of these does not mean we would never do the others.
That's
right?
True. Yes.
So if it decides what we do first, at some point, Jonathan, you need to watch some Zatoichi, and we need to talk about it on the podcast.
We're going to do the Zatoichi thing at some point. It just depends on, like, when do I force myself to budget the money to buy the box set?
Yeah.
Because I did not do it this November. November was too full of video games and life expenses. So, yes. All right. But there's always Christmas, so you never know.
Yep, it's never too late to buy some Zatoichi. That's what I always say.
And the next Criterion Flash sale should be in February, I think. So, you know, maybe I'll start putting pennies in a jar.
There you go.
Yes. All right. So let's see. We had one listener question. I tweeted back this listener, but I'm sure other people are wondering this, so I'm going to do it really quick here, Sean. Someone asked us, since the Persona dancing games come out in the U.S. on Tuesday, since this is Persona 3 and 5, Dancing Moon and Star Knight, respectively, they've been renamed in the U.S. I don't care about their renames. Will you be reviewing them even though you already reviewed the Japanese version? The answer is maybe.
I'm not getting the English versions, but I don't know what you're doing, Jonathan.
Yeah, I mean, Sean, you are fluent in Japanese. You do not need them. You're good.
Yeah.
I am getting them. Have I told you the story of how I got a price error on Amazon on that set?
No, I don't think this has come up.
Yeah, so they have out in the U.S., it's kind of like the one they did in Japan, where it's Persona 3 and 5 in a set, and then a download code for Persona 4 Dancing on the PS4. It does not come with the soundtracks the way the Japanese version did, but it comes with like an art book and some stuff. And that is coming out on Tuesday. It's $100 at retail. And Amazon, when I went to pre-order it, they had just put it up, and they had a price error, and they had it for $60 for that whole set. So I did that, and then I had a gift card, and I'm paying about $30 for that set, which feels obscene, but, you know, it's good.
Yeah. You know, if you're not getting the soundtrack, you should, the soundtrack is the thing, so you shouldn't have to pay full price anyways.
Yes. My brother has that set, so I have the soundtracks, but yes. So I will try to play them, but I want to be clear, like, Smash Bros. Is also coming out this week. Smash Bros. Takes precedent. It is a new game. It's the one I'm probably more excited for. In addition to Smash Bros., I am trying to finish Pokemon Let's Go. I'm trying to play more of Dragon Ball FighterZ before top 10 list time. I'm trying to play more of Hitman 2 before top 10 list time. My goal is before top 10 list, I want to finish at least one of the two Persona Dancing games in English so I have a better sense of the story stuff. But, you know, from a game mechanics standpoint, I did platinum both of those games.
Yeah.
So, like, we'll see. I'll play what I can play. There's a lot going on. I'm going to be traveling home for Christmas. And I'll be driving, so I can probably take my PS4 with me. But, you know, it is easier to just... My Switch is much easier for that because it just goes in the backpack, which the PS4 Pro... Many great things about the PS4 does not fit in a backpack. We will see about that. But, we'll talk about them, I'm sure, a little bit. And my little brother, who is the, you know, world champion in those games, is very excited about them and has already paid for... a second set of these games, and he's planning on rebuying all the DLC in English, and I'm like, Thomas,
oh God,
what are you doing? Where are you getting the money? And I don't know. I think he's dealing drugs now. That's very possible. He's doing that to you know, basically, some people, you know, do other side hustles to pay for their drug habit. I think he does a drug hustle to pay for his Persona habit. It's totally possible.
It seems feasible to me.
Yeah.
For sure.
All right. Speaking of habits, Sean... I am so fucking high on Dragon Ball Super.
Fuck yeah!
All right, this is the stuff portion. We already did some stuff. We're off the outline at this point, but we will do news in a little bit. But stuff. Okay, I know I'm late to this. Dragon Ball Super finished airing in March of this year, so I'm like 7 or 8 months late. But I am very near the end of Dragon Ball Super. You guys know I've been giving you little updates here and there as through the fall I have been watching the entire series start to finish and loving it more and more as it goes along. And I am now 10 episodes away from the end. Before we started recording, I finished episode 121. The last episode is 131. I am very near the end of the Universe Survival Arc, the Chikara no Taikai, the Tournament of Power. And the episode, I think you're looking it up, Sean, the episode I just finished is where they defeat Universe 3, and now all that is left is Universe 7, Goku's universe, and Universe 11, Toppo and Jiren's universe.
Yep.
And there are eight fighters left. Sorry, what?
Dispo.
Dispo doesn't matter.
he does matter. You don't know.
Okay.
I like Dispo.
Have good stuff coming up?
Yes, Dispo's cool.
Okay, good. But yes, so there are eight fighters left, which I thought was a great little touch because every other Dragon Ball tournament starts with eight fighters, so now they're ending with eight fighters. And Sean, this show, I have never done hallucinogenic drugs or hard drugs, but I imagine the sensation of that must be like the scene in Dragon Ball Super when Goku defeats Kefla by, spoilers, riding a fucking energy wave, doing a backflip, and Kamehameha-ing her in the face. What the hell?
Yeah, you know, that's the point where when I was watching Dragon Ball Super, like that was the episode, I think it must have aired like around this time in November, because I remember watching it during like Thanksgiving break in 2017, and getting to that point and like that was the most recent episode, and hitting that one and then stopped and was like, okay, I can't watch anymore until the rest of it's done because I would never be able to watch this week to week past this point because that is the coolest thing that has happened in Dragon Ball. And I said that on the podcast on whatever episode that was because I couldn't say it in spoiler territory because you hadn't seen it yet. But I said, this is the coolest fucking thing in all of Dragon Ball is that Goku using Migatte no Gokui and jumping up and fucking Ultimate Battle is playing and he's charging up his Kamehameha and he jumps into the air and then Kefla has that moment where he's just like, Kai, you asshole, you can't dodge in the air, fires the beam, and then Goku uses the little like energy orb in his cupped palms for the beginning of a Kamehameha and slides up the beam, flips, and Kamehameha's her in the face so hard it like cuts to it three different times from three different angles, and then it's like a full minute sequence of her flying out of the stage. It's fucking amazing.
It is. Sean, I've already watched it 5 times. Mm-hmm. I just saw the episode the other night. Because here's the thing. It has now been, because it was probably a year ago this time that you were telling me about this scene. Like, not what happens, but you said, hey, Goku fights a character named Kefla. That meant nothing to me at the time. It really meant nothing to me, because I'm like, there's no Kefla in this tournament. and then they fuse, and I'm like, oh, that's Kefla. But anyway, and so I had been waiting for it. I'm like, Sean says there's a moment in the Tournament of Power where Goku does the coolest thing ever, and I was kind of waiting around every turn. Is this, because there's a lot of cool things that happen in the Tournament of Power up to that point. It's no slouch, as story arcs go with cool shit. But that happens, and I already was like, by the time Goku is using Ultra Instinct and hopping along the different blocks of rubble as Ultimate Battle is playing, I was already like, this is the scene Sean was talking about. What's the kicker going to be? She fires that beam. I'm like, how does Goku dodge that beam? He can't fly. Oh my God! Because we can describe it all we want, but it's the way it is animated and shot and edited. It is just maximum cool, and oh, it was so, it's just, it is the ultimate, like, shonen anime dopamine hit that I think I've ever gotten. Holy crap.
Yeah, and I love that, like, I kind of wish that we hadn't been able to talk about, you know, because we took that week off where we pre-recorded a podcast where we could have broken the Tournament of Power stuff into neater chunks. Because the last time we talked about Dragon Ball,
an entire episode when I get back to Colorado. So
yeah, okay, good. That's a good idea. Because the last time we talked about Dragon Ball Super on here was before the Tournament of Power started for you, and so this is like that whole, because the Tournament of Power is like 2 or 3 arcs in one. Like, I would kind of say there's like up to Goku getting Migatte no Gokui. There's then up to getting to where you are now, which is where it is pared down to 2 universes. And then the fight between Universe 7 and Universe 11, and particularly the fight with Jiren, feels like it's its own fucking story arc. It's like, would you say you have like 10 episodes left or something? It feels to me like you have like 30 episodes, because it's so rich and it's like densely packed that, yeah, it's the Tournament of Power is next level shit for Dragon Ball Super. Like, everything up to that point for me is really good, and I really like the Goku Black stuff and all of that. But once the Tournament of Power really kicks in, it just becomes a whole different show that, like, is on a different plane from the stuff that came before it.
Well, and the Tournament of Power, as you say, the tournament section has, like, 3 parts, but the pre-tournament section also has multiple parts, because there's the part where they're setting up the tournament and they have the Universe Invitational Exhibition or whatever it's called.
Right, yeah.
With Zeno just wants to see what a tournament looks like. And then you have Goku going around and recruiting everyone, and it's basically a getting the band together, you know, story, and it's fucking great. And Goku gets Frieza out of hell. And,
oh my God.
And Frieza just becomes Spike from Buffy. He just becomes Spike from Buffy. And is it the most fanservice-y thing Dragon Ball has ever done? Yes. It is the most fanservice-y thing pretty much any anime has ever done, short of someone showing you their boobs. But as Frieza does not have boobs to show, him becoming Spike from Buffy is basically the most fanservice-y thing Dragon Ball is going to do. But I love it. It works. You know, it's not Spike from Buffy season 6 and 7, you know? It's not mushy Spike from Buffy. It's the period where you're like, there's tension there. He and Goku totally might fuck one day. But, you know, for now, if they're going to do it, they're really going to hate it when they do it together. So anyway, I'm being incoherent. But there's all of that, and then there's the tournament. And I'll admit, Sean, the first couple episodes of the tournament itself, when they go to the World of Void and it starts, I was underwhelmed for a couple episodes because it's kind of chaotic. I thought there wasn't a great sense of, like, the geography of the fighting stage and sort of who's who and who's where and how they're handling it. And, like, slowly it started to, like, you know, snap into place for me. And I think it's when they really start focusing on individual stories for the different episodes. Yeah. Like, I remember, this was not the first one I really loved, but there were a couple before this, but the one that, where I knew, like, okay, they're in a pretty rich vein of story here, is when Muten Roshi gets his own episode, and he just does the coolest shit up to that point. And it's such a good story about Master Roshi, like, you know, being relevant again.
Yeah.
And it kind of continues in that vein. And then, and this is what you're talking about, Phase 2 kicks off when Jiren comes out to play for the first time. And Goku goes Ultra Instinct is how they translate it in the subtitles on Crunchyroll. And It's like there, that's a two-parter that it basically looks like a movie. It looks like they put in a movie budget for the animation of that one. That's where you first get the insert song, Ultimate Battle. And I just remember being like, I didn't know this show had it in it, you know? I don't mean like Dragon Ball, the creation of Akira Toriyama. I mean Dragon Ball Super, you know, yeah. This show, which had been very good up to this point. I really love the Future Trunks stuff. But yeah, you're right. It's so amazing. And I feel like the best is maybe yet to come because it sure feels like they're building up to that. And just all the characters are so well serviced. You've got all the stuff with Gohan and Piccolo, and that's great. You've got the two androids. I love that Android 17 got to come back and be a relevant character because he is such a fucking badass. The episode I just watched where they fight the big robot, holy crap, he's cool in that one. That's got a moment that is probably number two on the list for me of cool moments in the tournament so far behind Goku defeating Kefla. It's so good. I'm loving it. It's... You know, I know Dragon Ball Super in general and this arc kind of in particular had mixed reception because its fans are picky. And it is, you know, I was worried whether, like, for me, like, it's 30... Because, like, the tournament itself is 35-ish episodes. It's a long stretch of stuff. That's longer than any tournament in any other Dragon Ball anime, even with filler and stuff. It's longer. It's longer than pretty much any other one-on-one fight. Maybe Frieza is longer, depending on how you break up the Frieza arc. So it's a lot. Yeah, I was wondering, are they going to be able to tell a story here? Is it going to be paced well? And for me, it is, because it is primarily action, but I think it has such a good grasp of character, and I think it's got so much going on that it really never gets dull, because if one character starts to feel stale or something, they've got 79 others to jump over to, because they're working with 80 characters in this arc, and 10 primary ones in Universe 7, and I'm as a longtime Dragon Ball fan, I'm really, really, really impressed by it, and... I can't wait to see the end, and they keep putting out trailers for that Broly movie, and that Broly movie, oh good God, I need that in my veins right now, Sean. Right fucking now. Oh my God. I can't, they won't let you buy tickets yet. If they let me buy tickets right now, I'd buy 50 fucking tickets. Do I need 50 fucking tickets? I don't, but I would.
That's maybe excessive. I really want to watch that movie, but I'm pretty steadfast in I will only buy the one ticket for myself.
Okay. Maybe I'll see it twice, but not 50 times. All right.
I'm not sure if it would be possible to see it 50 times.
But Sean, if that Broly trailer were coming out right after you saw the Kefla fight, you'd know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, no, I get it, man. Fucking, oh my God. Just some of that stuff. Because it is, like, for me, Dragon Ball Super, just when it starts getting into that stuff, it steps into this whole other realm where, with, like, the writing, yes, but then also just, like, the direction and the animation and the music come together to, like, the tone and mood and style of the Tournament of Power in places is, like, almost operatic, you know?
Yes, I agree.
It becomes so godly, you know, in that, like, literally you're dealing with characters like Goku, Vegeta, Jiren, Toppo, that are, you know, whose powers begin to rival the gods of destruction that are all watching, and then you have Zeno-sama, and it's like the stakes are literal universes being erased, and I will... Like clockwork, like within like couples of weeks, just be like, oh, I like YouTube's algorithm will surface some Dragon Ball Super video from that period of, oh, here's when Goku gains Ultra Instinct for the first time. Here's that part from the Kefla fight. Here's this part with Vegeta. Here's this thing with Jiren. And there are just like 3-minute clips from these episodes that I just like to watch in those little chunks on YouTube because they're so well crafted little scenes that are so delicious, and some of it is, I think this is, weirdly enough, even though he's not in the action, this is my favorite part for Beerus in the show.
He's I actually kind of agree. He's really well used. If you, like, take out the two movie retellings where, you know, Beerus was, like, originated in the films, I would agree with that.
Yeah, because he gets to be... It's almost like what the role that Master Roshi had in the original tournaments once he wasn't fighting as Jackie Chun and being able to, like, provide commentary. But it's like his... Part of the thing that's so great is seeing his respect grow for all the other fighters. And, like, particularly there's a lot of that stuff with Master Roshi, like, I found so touching that, like, Beerus starts to see, like, what is in this old man. Oh.
There's a moment in the episode, one of the episodes I just watched, where he says, you know, Goku no Musuko. Yeah. Gohan. And the way he says that, like, he says his name, finally, because he had always called him, like, Goku's kid.
Yeah.
And now he's like, no, you have a name and it's Gohan. I was like, I'm getting choked up here. It's great.
Yeah, and then there's the moment where Goku gets sucked into the black hole made by his own spirit bomb, which is just fucking amazing. And then Beerus, everyone thinks that he's maybe dead, and Beerus has that moment where he said, Is this it? Is this where it ends for you, Goku? And then Goku, the energy starts shaking and the whole world of the void starts shaking. And I love...
He's coming.
Yeah, yeah. Whis says, do you, like, have something you want to say, Beerus? And yeah, he's just, like, close up on Beerus's mouth. Kuzo.
It's so good. Good. Oh, my God. Because I agree, like, it's... I can understand... if you're a Dragon Ball fan and this isn't for you, because Dragon Ball is many things and there are parts of Dragon Ball that aren't for me, you know, fucking Broly movies or something. But like, I think this works for me as I think the core of Toriyama's creation is there. And I think it's still the beating heart of the thing, but I like that Super, it is not trying to be Dragon Ball Z. It's not trying to be original Dragon Ball. And I think especially in the Universe Survival arc, it is becoming its own. As you say, it's almost got more in common with like a Hideaki Anno anime or something, where it's like we are going full mood and tone and style, and as a stylistic piece, as this operatic stylistic thing, almost more like a musical or something, but instead of, you know, singing, they're punching each other. It is kind of like a good martial arts movie in that sense.
Yeah.
It is just so unbelievable to watch because it is. And it is amazing if you go back to the early episodes of Super when they were retelling the movies and it looked like they were drawing it with crayon on the back of a napkin. Like, to this, it's like they got their shit together so fucking hard, I kind of can't believe it, that turnaround happened within 3 years. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like if you want a comparison, find the clip from, I think it's episode 4 of Super or episode 5, where Goku and Beerus have the fight on Kaio-sama's planet, which is infamously, it's the one where, like, it looks like they're drawn with, like, pencils on the back of a fucking, like, IHOP menu. Like, it is so low rent. And then watch the Kefla scene we were talking about. And it's like, how did the same show produce those two scenes? And Dragon Ball's always had a little bit of that because, you know, multiple studios work on it. But I don't think there's anything that vast a gap in the original run of Dragon Ball or Dragon Ball Z to what they were able to do over the course of Super in terms of locking it into place. And the same guy who directed the Tournament of Power arc is directing the Broly movie, and I'm good with that.
Fucking yes.
Fucking yes. All right, so that's enough Dragon Ball talk. Let's go ahead and move on. Sean, you want to do some news?
What's going on in the news, Jonathan?
Well, speaking of Hideaki Anno animes, maybe I set this up as a way to get into this. Neon Genesis Evangelion is coming to Netflix in spring 2019, which was such a big announcement that Netflix cut a pretty good trailer. We're like, hey, clearly that you guys hired someone who knows what anime is to cut this trailer. And it's coming in spring 2019. It will be the complete original series plus the two original movies, not the new Evangelion remake movies.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the end of Evangelion and whatever the other one was. Evangelion has been out of print in America since the license expired in 2011, and it's been unavailable commercially in North America for this entire decade, basically. Because of that, I will say, I've never seen Neon Genesis Evangelion because it's really fucking hard to find.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people are in that boat now where, like, these rebuild movies are coming out and they look cool, but I really don't want to watch those until I've seen the original thing. And for whatever reason, no one's been able to get their hands on Evangelion on that license. But hey, Netflix has more money than they know what to do with, so they have gotten hold of the license. It looks like this is a pretty nice HD master they have of the series. I assume in Japan there are nicer masters of the show out, and they will have the entire thing on Netflix in spring 2019, which is probably the most excited I've been for a Netflix exclusive ever, because I'm really excited to watch this, and that is really cool that they're doing it. I would love a nice, you know, physical release as well at some point. I don't know if that'll be in the cards with Netflix having the license now, but this is certainly better than nothing. And for a while, we've basically had nothing other than really expensive sets on eBay.
Yeah, or you could watch it the way I watched it, which is trawling the internet for, you know, it's just been one of those shows that's not been reasonably available for as long as I have been, like, actively watching anime, so that is how I watched it, you can imagine. Yeah, it's awesome. I'm glad that it's just... It's because it's such a seminal show, both in anime history, but I think also... There's two different versions of anime history. There's anime history in Japan, and there's anime history in America. And you know, like, for instance, Cowboy Bebop, tremendously important show in the history of anime in America. A curious footnote in the history of anime in Japan, because the influences are very different, and the amount of influence they have on the different cultures are really different. And it's one of the things that's I think, really critical about getting Evangelion back, is that it is... It's both really heavily influential in Japan, but it's also really heavily influential and important in its own way in our own, like, artistic culture and how we've taken things from Evangelion and interpreted it and brought it forward. So,
to my understanding, it's one of those shows, like, every up-and-coming director of the 90s saw and, like, really deeply internalized.
Yeah, it's like that and Ghost in the Shell, like, kind of sit next to each other, for sure. And yeah, it's awesome. I will definitely do a rewatch of it. Maybe we'll talk about it on the podcast.
Add that to the list. We just go full... Actually, we might want to do that anyway when it comes out, because that would be fun. All right. Yeah, so I'm really excited that they did that, and I wonder... I mean, Netflix has never done bad by anime. They've always had an anime section. It's kind of ebbed and flowed in how good it is. At some points, it's been really great. I wonder if, like, this is... Because they made such a push for this. Like, this was not, like, a little tweet or press release. They made a fucking trailer for it. I hope maybe they can... Maybe there's other, like, anime with expired licenses Netflix could just, you know, swing their giant money dick around and get the access to.
Yeah. No, it's definitely... Because they've... You know, it feels like it's been a slow process, but they've been getting more committed to anime, even if they did take Persona 3, the movie number 2, Midsummer Night's Dream, off of their service, tragically. They helped fund Devilman Crybaby, which is exclusive on Netflix, earlier this year, which is a pretty good show. And so it feels like they're getting in that space a little bit stronger, because anime is fucking huge, dude. Anime is big over here. It's been big for a couple of years, and it feels like Netflix is starting to figure that out and catch up.
I mean, legitimately, one of their bigger competitors, I have to imagine, is Crunchyroll.
Yeah.
Like, with a certain demographic of, like, young people, I have a Crunchyroll subscription more consistently at this point than I do a Netflix one. You know, Netflix kind of goes off and on depending on what I'm watching, but...
Yeah, me too.
You know. Yeah. All right. Speaking of Netflix, this whole saga is so interesting. Daredevil has been canceled at Netflix after its third season, essentially putting the final nail in the coffin of the Marvel-Netflix partnership. There are two outstanding... there are technically three outstanding shows. There is Jessica Jones, which is filming its third season. I imagine that will be its final season. I cannot imagine there's a world where they keep Jessica Jones around but canceled everything else. The Punisher was renewed a while ago for a second season, but nothing has happened with it. They have not filmed anything. They have not scheduled any filming. I imagine that will not be happening. And then The Defenders, I don't think has ever technically been canceled, but, you know, math.
They originally advertised that as, like, a limited series event kind of thing, so I think it was implied... There's not necessarily going to be another season.
Yeah, but if The Defenders had been a hit, there would have been a second season.
Yeah, definitely. But, like, yeah. I think it would have been like this is The Defenders 2 or something.
Okay, yeah. So I think there will probably be that last season of Jessica Jones. The contractual obligation season of Jessica Jones will dribble out at some point. But, yeah, it's clearly done. I think, you know, people have been pointing to... You know, Disney has their own streaming service launching next year, Disney Plus, which would obviously put a wrench in a lot of these negotiations. But again, if these shows were doing really well, if they were creatively happy with these shows, they would find a way to continue this one way or another, because notably, these are not going to be on Disney Plus. I know there's been a lot of clickbait articles being like, will Daredevil be on Disney Plus? It will not. That's been pretty definitively established. Just in part, this is how contracts work.
Yeah.
These were Netflix shows. They were co-produced with Marvel and Disney, but they were Netflix productions. Netflix put the money in. You cannot just take... Disney would have to buy the rights. They would have to buy the actors out of their contracts. And again, if the shows were really in a successful place, they might do that, but they aren't. They've been having a lot of problems. I think they've been having problems getting the hype together. It's also a poorly kept secret that the movie people at Marvel hate the TV people at Marvel, which have been two completely separate divisions. The TV people have been very resistant to taking notes, to working with the movie people. The movie people have kind of always looked down on the TV people. And, you know, at the end of the day, Kevin Feige is the guy who produces the $2 billion movies, so what he says is going to go. And it sounds like on Disney Plus, they will be producing Marvel shows, but those are going to be run by the movie people. The TV division is essentially being, like, phased out. I think there's... The only one left on network television, I think, is Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. And that's going away at some point, I'm sure. So, yeah, this is definitely the end of an era. It's too bad, because I do think there were points where there was obviously promise in these shows. You know, 6 episodes worth of promise in 13 episode seasons.
Yes.
But, yeah, I think just the zeitgeist passed them by. They could not, you know, quite get it together. They had this stubborn insistence on making 13 episodes, which was always just the wrong idea, because they were also stubbornly insistent on never, ever, 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 ever broaching the idea of doing anything episodic. It had to be 100% serialized 100% of the time. I will probably go back and watch Daredevil Season 3 now, because I would like to finish that particular journey, because Daredevil was the only one of these I was particularly invested in, and I am... bummed that Charlie Cox will not be playing Daredevil anymore. I'm bummed that, you know, Kristen Ritter will not be playing Jessica Jones. I'm bummed that Mike Coulter will not be playing Luke Cage. No one gives a fuck about Iron Fist. But, like, those other three were such great pieces of casting. It is a bummer. Disney is probably never going to be able to use those actors again, unless something crazy happens. But yeah, like, it's just crazy to me that this whole thing was announced and the deal was inked in the wake of the first Avengers movie. That was 2012. It hasn't been that long. And in 6 years, it went from, like, the biggest TV deal ever to they're just kind of dribbling out, you know, cancellation notices here and there. And, yeah, I would love a good oral history on what the fuck happened with the Netflix shows.
Yeah, I agree, because it just feels like they had the stuff that is, like, the stuff you can't rely on to get in place to work right, which is oftentimes like the actors, because it also wasn't just the lead person. It was like everybody in those shows, you know, like Vincent D'Onofrio as the Kingpin is fucking fantastic.
You're
like,
never going to get a better Kingpin.
Yeah. You couldn't ask for a better live action Kingpin. And like, that's the kind of stuff that usually you can have a show that's like, oh, this show's pretty well written and they've got some good ideas. But like, if the actor chemistry isn't there for something that's so character driven, it just kind of, like, falters. You know, like, if X-Files Season 1, if you did not just stumble on David Duchovny and Gillian Anderson being what they are, that show would have been nothing. It would be an interesting footnote in the history of science fiction television. Oh, there was this attempt to make the X-Files. It had some decent scripts, but it never went anywhere because people didn't get invested in the characters enough. And they had all of that stuff. I so desperately want more Daredevil with Charlie Cox, and I definitely want more Jessica Jones with Kristen Ritter, and more Luke Cage with Mike Coulter. But if all they're going to do is do this weird, like, 13-hour movie thing that's just arbitrarily split into chunks, and then every once in a while you have, like, one or two of those chunks that happen to work really well, it's like, that's just not a feasible structure for a TV show. It never has been, and streaming did not change anything in that way. And it's just, like, so fucking frustrating to see them waste so much potential that I'm not sure if I will ever go back and watch Daredevil Season 3, because part of, like, my investment in that, it feels kind of dead knowing that it's never going forward. And it's like, they broke it so hard by having Iron Fist be a dud, and thus I didn't want to watch that, and then I didn't want to watch The Defenders. And now it's just like, I could watch the Season 3 of Daredevil, or I could catch up on an anime I haven't seen, or I could watch the Apu trilogy, or whatever, you know. I could spend my time in better ways than watching Season 3 of Daredevil is what it feels like. And that really bums me out, because I was so stoked coming out of Daredevil Season 1 6 years ago. Whenever we did that podcast, it would be tragic to go back and listen to us talking then and being like, oh my god, this show is so cool. It's got some missteps here and there, like the last episode, and there's a couple of episodes it's like maybe too long, but fucking holy shit, man, when the show was cracking, it was cracking and it was awesome. And now it's just gone.
Yeah. Two thoughts. One, I'm regretting that I have turned the Apu trilogy, one of the masterpieces of world cinema, into a weird punching bag in this episode. Y'all should watch the Apu trilogy. It's just not the kind of thing we cover here.
I want to stress, it's not. I'm not taking that as a punching bag. I'm saying, like legitimately, I should not spend so much of my time watching bad Netflix shows and should watch really good movies I know I would like.
I know. Neither of us have meant to do it, Sean. It's just happened, is my point.
Okay.
That's all. Anyway, but my second thought is just, the thing to me that has been so fascinating about this entire journey with the Marvel Netflix shows is that I'm someone who watches, and it ebbs and flows how much I watch, the DC shows on the CW. And so I've always looked at the Marvel Netflix shows and been like, how are you not getting your shit together? Because I look to my right and I'm like, the CW's been doing it for years. And they have more shows, and they make more episodes, and they do much more ambitious crossovers than the Defenders, and they do it every fucking... They did a musical episode! They did a musical episode with The Flash and Supergirl. It wasn't great, but it was pretty good. They figured that shit out. You guys can't, like... You guys have to make fewer episodes with... Some of those are also heroes that I think are just easier to do than, like, Supergirl or The Flash or... Because they also had much more money than the CW does for 22 episodes of The Flash. And The Flash is not an easy superhero to do with a small budget. You know, his powers are not... Same with, like, Supergirl. You can't just, like, you know, wish this away. So, like, I've always been fascinated by that because the CW, like, those shows are not perfect. I've kind of fallen off The Flash because I think it had some rocky seasons in the middle. It's a lot of TV to catch up on. But, like, Supergirl, for instance, I haven't talked about it on the podcast yet, but I've been wanting to. Supergirl Season 4, if you have never watched it, just watch this season. You don't need to have seen the other seasons. I would really implore you, watch some of what they're doing this season on Supergirl. It's not perfect, but it is basically what the Marvel Netflix shows always wanted to be, I think. Because it is serialized. They have not really been doing Enemy of the Week stories this year. They have been telling one, like, continuous story. And yet the way they have paced it out and built week-to-week things so it still does feel episodic and satisfying week-to-week, and they've had stories, is really interesting. And it's also got a dramatic heft that is really impressive to me, where Supergirl this year is just full on doing an allegory for Trumpism. Like, that is just, it's completely committed to that. It is 100% the villain is basically the Supergirl version of a neo-Nazi white supremacist, but for this story, it's aliens literally from outer space, because in Supergirl, a lot of, like, Supergirl herself are aliens who are, you know, settling on Earth, and so the villain is a guy who's going, you know, Earth first, that kind of thing. And it can be a little eye-rolly here and there how heavily an allegory it is, but they're also really heavily trying to tell that story seriously, and they did an entire episode where, like, the main cast was barely in it. Melissa Benoist was, like, out for the episode, and it was about how the main villain, Agent Liberty, went from being, like, a nice college guy to a radicalized, you know, human supremacist, and basically told this story that, like, you know, the fucking New York Times won't write stories about because they're too busy interviewing people in, you know, coffee shops in Ohio, right? Like, and it was really interesting to me because, again, not a perfect episode, but it really went for what it was going for, and it was pretty sobering to watch, and it's easily the best season Supergirl has had since the first when it was on CBS. And it kind of blows me away. And I also know that we're about to get the annual crossover with Arrow and The Flash. And they're doing a whole thing where they're going to introduce Batwoman. And they're going to have some stuff in Gotham City. And those are just every year, those are the most fun fucking things. I've never watched more than, I think, the first season of Arrow. Not because I don't like it, just... It's 22 episodes a year and there's 7 seasons. But I love when I get to do the crossovers because I really like the Arrow characters even when it's just those couple of episodes. And I think they've found this mode where they're able to do these separate shows. The shows can try new and different things. They can be good on their own merits. And you don't have to watch all of them to enjoy the crossovers. You can kind of watch what you want, come to the crossovers. They're going to be fun whether you know it all or not. And if you do want to put in the time to watch all of them, you're going to get some pretty good superhero television. And I'm not saying it's not hard work, but the Marvel Netflix deal, they had more resources to deal with, you know? Like, they could have... This is not a secret how to do this. There was a very clear example right over there. It really is, I've said this before, the TV Marvel versus DC thing is the exact qualitative opposite of the movie Marvel versus DC thing, where in the movies, Marvel's got their shit together, DC doesn't know what the fuck they're doing, and on TV, DC's got its shit together. Marvel doesn't know what the fuck they're doing. So it's very curious to me. But yeah, once Daredevil got canceled, man, it's just like it's very clearly that whole deal is dead.
Because they came in with Daredevil. If Daredevil gets cut short, it was the best show. It was the most solid show. Even if, like, I think depending on your preferences, you definitely like Jessica Jones or Luke Cage, you might like more. But Daredevil had like the least problems, I guess.
Yeah. Jessica Jones, you know, I think you could argue had some higher highs in terms of what it was reaching for as a superhero show and allegory. And Luke Cage probably had some, you know, very high points in terms of how it was, you know, incorporating the culture it portrayed into it cinematically and narratively. But, you know, yeah, I don't think anyone would argue that Daredevil was the most consistent. It did not have the weird incest twins that Jessica Jones did for a season.
Yeah, it's just like there was never an episode, even when Daredevil was not the best, like, and it was not doing the best that it could do, I never watched an episode in the first two seasons of Daredevil that I was like, I wish I was not watching this episode of television right now. And Jessica Jones and Luke Cage both hit that point a couple of times in their respective season ones. And it's like, I don't know why I'm watching this show right now. Yeah. Get to the fucking point. Holy shit.
Well, pour one out for the Marvel Netflix deal. If nothing else, it did give us a season of television in which David Tennant's Doctor Who voice was forever stained by him playing a horrific psychopathic rapist.
Yep.
All right.
And Vincent D'Onofrio, I love you. You're such a good kingpin. Just put him in one of those. Just put him in a Spider-Man movie, even if it's only for like a 5-minute scene. Just put him in a Spider-Man movie, please.
I would not be surprised if those conversations are happening, Sean.
I hope they are.
That would involve Sony, Marvel, Disney, and Netflix at this point, but they're probably happening. All right. So speaking of Doctor Who, which we just mentioned in passing with David Tennant, you guys have maybe been following this if you've been listening to our news segments, but Doctor Who, the home video division, has been sort of testing the waters with Blu-ray sets. Last year they started with a season 12 set, which was Tom Baker's first season. That came out in Britain just as The Complete Season 12. In America they called it The Complete Tom Baker Season 1, which was very confusing. Then they did Peter Davidson's first season, which is Season 19. They called it Peter Davidson Season 1 over here. I think it's either just coming out this month or came out at the end of last month, but anyway, they're doing that. These are very comprehensive Blu-ray sets where they've obviously got all the episodes, but also all the special features from the DVDs, as well as significant new special features. So it's really like they're putting it all in one archival box, and it's very cool. It kind of made sense, I think, to do one Tom Baker season. That Peter Davidson season has a lot of stuff on film, so it could look better on Blu-ray, so that one made sense as a season. Peter Davidson is also just a popular Doctor, made sense to do. Yeah. You know, they're not going to be able to do this really with, like, the first and second Doctors, and I don't know if they would want to do this with the sixth Doctor, so, like, there's, you know, there's kind of limits on what they can and can't do with all of this. So it kind of made sense to do that. They've announced the third set they're doing, and this is where it gets confusing, because now they've announced they're doing Season 18, which is Tom Baker's last season, and is being marketed in the U.S. as The Complete Tom Baker Season 7, just to really confuse all of us. And so, yeah, you can now watch Tom Baker's last season and Peter Davidson's first season, which obviously bump up right against each other, Season 18 and 19, 4th and 5th Doctor. I'm not quite sure why they chose this one. It's obviously a very important turning point in the history of the show, and I'm sure the bonus features are really... I actually have some of those DVDs. They do have great features. And I'm sure it'll be an awesome set. It's just very clear, like, they have not yet committed to, like, okay, we're just going to pick a point and go forward from that. I think they're still kind of testing the waters here, and it's very interesting to me. The reason we're talking about this, though, Sean, is that the Doctor Who YouTube channel put out a video advertising this box set, as they are wont to do, but the wonderful part is that they got Mr. Tom Baker himself to narrate over the video as if he was giving a travelogue presentation about the places they visited in this very weird historical season of Doctor Who, and it was delightfully odd in the way Tom Baker is always delightfully odd, and it put a smile on my face.
Yeah, it's a great trailer. People who haven't seen it should go watch it. And it is just, like, for me, because you texted me and, like, linked me that trailer to make sure I watched it before on this, because I didn't know that he narrated it. I saw that that set was announced, and I saw that there was a trailer for it, but I was like, I don't need to watch a trailer for this season of Doctor Who I watched, like, fucking 6 years ago, or however long it's been since I watched any of these things. And then, yeah, you said Tom Baker narrates it. I watched it, and it highlighted for me just how fucking batshit crazy that last season of his is. Because for people who don't know, his last season is the first season that John Nathan Turner came on, who was the producer for that whole last stretch of the show for that season, all the Fifth Doctor, all the Sixth Doctor, all the Seventh Doctor, to the cancellation. And so that was the point where, like, Tom Baker basically ran the show. Then that was, you know, and he was, you know, such a larger-than-life presence on it. And then they brought John Nathan Turner in, who made all these crazy changes and introduced three whole companions over the course of that season and got rid of Romana too. And they changed his costume and put the fucking question marks on his lapel. And he has this terrible, ugly burgundy red costume that just looks fucking awful. And there's a whole arc in the middle, the E-Space trilogy, which is where if you thought Adric was a human, he's not really, because he's from E-Space, which is like the like negative coordinate. I forget how the word they explain what the fuck E-Space is, but there's a whole trilogy of stories in the middle that take place in basically another dimension called E-Space. And then you go to Trakken, and then the Doctor fights the Master and discovers a place where math changes reality, and then he gets pushed off of a big building and then falls and regenerates. It's like one of the most strange seasons of Doctor Who ever, and that trailer just highlights all of that, where you see, like, fucking Meglos, the cactus man who becomes a duplicate of the Doctor, but he's like a cactus. It's like, and I love they show the clip from the Leisure Hive, which is the first story in that season, where Tom Baker is, like, split into, like, five pieces in this weird, like, vision. It's so strange. And it, even though I know that season is not particularly good, like, the Leisure Hive is okay, Keeper of Trakken is okay, and Legopolis is interesting, I need to watch the season again now, just because it's like, what the fuck was this season of Doctor Who? Holy shit.
Well, now you can on Blu-ray, which is cool. I mean, I'm happy that they're doing these sets at all, you know?
Yeah,
it's really cool. I do intend on, I've picked up the Tom Baker season one. I haven't done the Davidson one yet. I'm not, like, there in my Doctor Who rewatch, which is sort of on pause for Dragon Ball and stuff. Been on pause all year. Time gets away from you.
Yeah.
But anyway, you know, I will want to pick these up at some point. I don't quite get their strategy with this, yeah. Because I thought, like, to me, the obvious candidate for after the Peter Davidson season is you should do one of John Pertwee's first two seasons, because John Pertwee's first season is just amazing and perfect, and you already have Spearhead from Space on Blu-ray and HD. It's the one episode that is entirely on film, so it looks great. Or you could do John Pertwee's second season, which is where you get Joe Grant, and you also, that season is entirely Master-centric, and it's just one of the best seasons of Doctor Who. You should do that, obviously. I think they should do... You could do Peter Davidson's last season, because it's very interesting, because you would get the twofer of The Caves of Androzani and The Twin Dilemma.
Right. Oh, fuck. Right. It's technically the season finale. Yeah. I always forget that, because I put it in the Sixth Doctor box, and I always forget.
You know, I think the Sixth Doctor's second season would be an interesting candidate, because they've done that as a box set before.
Yeah, Trial of the Time Lord.
Yeah, the Seventh Doctor, frankly, you could just do the entire run of the Seventh Doctor in one box, because his seasons were so short that, like, all added up, they're about as long as one normal-length season. And you could do things like, and also you need the Fourth Doctor's second and third seasons, because you would get the entire Hinchcliffe-Holmes run. So, like, those are more obvious candidates to me than getting Tom Baker's last season, and even, like, for Peter Davidson, again, I would think you would want to do his last, not his first.
Yeah, I mean, his first season's okay.
Yeah, but, you know, so I'm very curious if this continues. I would love for them to do something with the first two Doctors at some point. Obviously, you would not be able to get, all the episodes do not exist, but you could do something with that. Like, you could do one first Doctor box. You might have to split that in two, but the second Doctor, you could definitely do it all in one box.
Yeah.
And that would be interesting to me, and we'll see if they go there. Some of that I actually think would really benefit from the Blu-ray upgrade. It's an interesting initiative they're doing. I'm wondering and hoping if it continues. If nothing else, it seems like the excitement around the new season of Doctor Who, as bad as it is, has given them license to do more home video experiments. So hats off to them for that. Maybe the Cactus Man, they had to see Tom Baker as a Cactus Man in HD.
Meglos is one of, like, the most infamously worse episodes of Doctor Who. Like, it's like that, Time Flight, Twin Dilemma, those are, like, just, like, they're fucking terrible. So, yeah, if you're someone who has never watched classic Doctor Who, and you want to get some home, like, physical media, like, you might want to get this one. Don't start with watching this one, though. Get the first, like, because they basically just said, let's take the Tom Baker's first season, which is arguably his best, and let's take his last season, which is almost certainly his worst. It's just like, I texted this to you when we were texting about it. I would just love to see someone who's the only thing they know about Doctor Who at all was just they saw that fucking Blu-ray set, and then they saw the last season Blu-ray set, and it was like, didn't even know there's anything in between. I would just like love to see what your idea of Doctor Who is from those two so polar opposite takes on the character, and yet it's the same fucking actor. Because Tom Baker's run was so long that by the time you get to the end of it, it's practically a different TV show.
It's great. Like, they could have done the Key to Time season. Like, there's so many obvious candidates.
Yes.
It's weird, bizarre. I mean, this one has never been collected. That is the difference. Hmm. Key to Time has been collected. Trial of a Time Lord has been collected. This one has not been collected. Those collections are out of print. I own the Key to Time one. I wouldn't need a Blu-ray upgrade of that. But anyway, let's go ahead and move on. Last piece of news for today. I'm cutting one of these out, Sean, because we're running long. But let's do, just because I'm fascinated by it, how the hell did the PlayStation Classic make it out the door at Sony, Sean?
Because they just want a dumb, bad stocking stuffer and did not give a shit about quality is what it feels like.
That's exactly what it feels like. You know, in contrast to the NES Classic and the Super NES Classic, which, you know, you may not want them or like them or whatever, but, like, they were good at what they did, right? Like, they had
right.
good lineup of games. They were well-built, they had great emulation, they looked good, they had lots of good features. If you wanted to play a solid collection of Super NES or NES games true to form, you could not complain about those systems, right?
Yeah.
For the PlayStation Classic, like, the best breakdown of this I've seen, but everyone is doing reviews, not necessarily just for, like, the clicks. I think people are genuinely fascinated by this thing because it is so bad. Digital Foundry did, as they are wont to do, the most in-depth video on this, and it's bad emulation. There's awful visual scaling. Effects are misrendered. Sounds are messed up. My favorite example is that in Final Fantasy VII, the battle music plays at the wrong speed, which, boy, if you can't get that one right, I don't know what to tell you. Again, Digital Foundry broke this all down. Lots of people have been publishing on it. 9 of the 20 games on the collection are inexplicably the European PAL versions, which are slower, running at 50 hertz rather than 60 hertz, which is what the PlayStation natively output at, and it's what the PlayStation Classic natively outputs at. And so all of those 9 games not only run slow, but they judder significantly. As Digital Foundry pointed out, the PSP and thus the PS Vita ran these games perfectly. The PS3 once in a while had more trouble with them, but by and large, Sony's in-house emulator, which they are not using on this, they're using the PSX emulator from the internet. Though Sony ran them well, somehow they're not running them well now. I think it's very clearly what you said, Sean. They wanted to shit out a stocking stuffer and didn't really care about it. But it would not have been hard to care about it. It's like, the model for how to do this exists. They're clearly aware of it. They ripped it off pretty obviously. This feels more in the vein of, like, those, you know, Genesis Classic things you see in the aisles at Bed Bath & Beyond than the Nintendo ones, which felt like a good premium product. The difference is, this is the most expensive of these to ever come out. It's $100. And, yeah, what a ripoff. What the hell, Sony?
Yeah, no, it's just, it is that thing where it's like, when I heard that there were, like, because I think it's particular, it's Tekken 3 is the PAL version of Tekken 3, which is, like, infamously bad. Even I, who, like, you know, only vaguely follow that kind of stuff, have heard tell of, the fucking PAL version. I think someone from, like, the Tekken fighting game scene tweeted, like from, like, a video, he's like, oh, that's the PAL version of Tekken 3, the unplayable version of Tekken 3. It's like, as soon as you have a person who's in the Tekken scene say, oh, the version of the game that's on this console is unplayable, that's where you're like, okay, they don't give a shit.
Yeah.
Because I didn't watch the whole Digital Foundry video. Do they explain or have even a hypothesis for why they would have used the PAL versions? Because I find it so bizarre.
It's very bizarre. They went into a certain amount of depth. They do not have any conclusive hypothesis, and it cannot explain all 9 of the games. They did run the PSX emulator on an Android or a NVIDIA Shield tablet, which has similar architecture to a Nintendo Switch, and they tried the NTSC version of the games on those to see, like, because that's, like, similarly powered to the PlayStation Classic, and it has trouble with that. It has trouble with the PSX emulator that they are using has trouble with the NTSC version of the games on underpowered hardware. So that might have been why they did that. Although Digital Foundry also notes that still runs better than the PAL version. It's an improved version of the NTSC version, but it runs better than the PAL. And again, Sony has an in-house version of this emulator that was on the PS fucking P that ran all these just fine in their original NTSC versions. So that was the closest they came to figuring it out. You know, if Digital Foundry can't figure it out, you fucked up. Because they are tech detectives over there.
It's bad.
Yeah, it's bad. I just... 6 years of asking Sony for some kind of backward compatibility for all our PS1 classics on the PS4, and they gave us this, and this was basically a clenched fist full of shit, and they're asking for $100 for it, so, yeah. Fuck you guys.
Dave, man, I got my PS Vita. I'm okay.
Yeah. All right. Let's move on. Sean.
Yes.
We are now moving to our topic for today, which I have called on the outline, Video Game Orgy. Which is kind of what it feels like. We're getting fucked in all directions by video games. Maybe that was too graphic.
Yeah, this is maybe a bit much.
All right. We are going to be talking about, among other things, Red Dead Redemption 2, Hitman 2, Pokemon Let's Go, anything you have. But, Sean, I want to start with a game that we have been talking about since January, which is Dragon Ball FighterZ.
Yep, it's a good fucking game, huh?
Y'all thought we were done talking about Dragon Ball. We're never done talking about Dragon Ball. Not on this podcast.
Fuck yeah.
Just a couple of minutes on this because I have a story to tell. So Sean, I finally broke down and I repurchased Dragon Ball FighterZ on my Nintendo Switch so I could play it there on the go. It was on sale over Black Friday and I had some extra... It was on sale and then there were also places where you could get Nintendo eShop cards on sale and I bought some of those so I could pay for Smash Bros. Ultimate. And I got a little extra so I could do Dragon Ball FighterZ. And Amazon gave me like $20 for the PS4 version. So I'm like, I'd be stupid not to do it. Anyway, Dragon Ball FighterZ is awesome on Switch. Don't worry about it. If you're worried about like the Joy-Con or the performance. No, it's great. It's fucking great. I really want to stress this. It's like the visuals are slightly downgraded from the PS4. But only in terms of the resolution of some assets. Not the resolution of the entire game. Not the performance. It runs at a rock solid 60 FPS. I know in the beta on Switch there were some frame drops. That's in the version I'm playing, which it's been a couple months. But in the version I'm playing, I've noticed nothing. It runs completely smoothly at 60 FPS. It's 1080p on your TV. It's 720p on your handheld system. Again, some assets are a little rezzed down, but the artwork in Dragon Ball FighterZ is so good, like that really does not affect it to me. Like, even if they have slightly more jagged outlines, you don't really notice it because it looks hand-drawn is kind of the whole idea of the game. Yeah. So it runs great, and that's awesome. And in terms of controlling, I have to tell you, Sean, this kind of surprised me. I have a much easier time playing it on the Joy-Con than I did on the PS4 controller.
Huh.
Let me tell you why. On the PS4 controller, so Dragon Ball FighterZ is a real fighting game, which means to play it, you have to have at least a passing comfort with quarter circle turns, right?
Yes, yeah, it's Street Fighter style, quarter circle forward, punch, fireball kind of moves.
You don't have to be an expert, but you have to be able to do it, right?
Yeah, no, there's nothing, because they don't have anything like the Shoryuken move, which is like forward, down, forward, punch. It's all quarter circles or half circles.
Yeah, so you have to be able to do a little bit of that. I've never been good at those kind of turns, and on the PS4 controller, I could never find a way to do it that was comfortable for me. My instinct, and I know this is weird, but like it felt better to me to use the control stick, but it was virtually impossible to do a quarter circle turn with that on the PS4, because the PS4 sticks are just, they're fine, but they're better for something like a Red Dead 2 that don't take a lot of precision than they are for a fighting game. And so you would use the D-pad, and the D-pad on the PS4 is really good, and it's good for this kind of thing, but I just never felt entirely comfortable with it. The thing is, on the Switch, you cannot use the D-pad. The split D-pad on the Switch does not work for Dragon Ball FighterZ. Like, technically, you can try it if you want. I have not been able to pull off a quarter circle turn move on it, and I think it's because you have to be able to hit two directions at once, which is kind of impossible with a split D-pad.
Yeah.
So, but if you want to use the sticks, here's the God Brain mode. The Switch sticks have less travel, and they snap into place more easily. I'm not kidding, Sean. I almost never fail when I want to pull off a quarter circle move on the Joy-Con. Even on the Pro Controller, it's a little harder for me because the sticks just, they have more movement. it honestly, if you can kind of just, if you're used to like the way they move, it, you can go down, back, or, you know, down, forward pretty easily on the Joy-Con, and I'm actually having more fun with the game. I'm getting better at it. And of course, if you play it on the Pro Controller, it's fine. If you really like play this with D-pad only, you probably don't want to play this on Switch, because it's I know there are newer versions of the Switch Pro Controller that have fixed the issue with the D-pad, I'm pretty sure. I do not own one of those, so I can't speak to that. The D-pad is just kind of mushy on the original Pro Controller. But if you're playing with the sticks, and then all the other buttons are the same, obviously, it's worked really well for me. Plus, you can take Dragon Ball FighterZ on the bus, and, you know, on a bus ride, I can fit in like 2 or 3 matches, and it's really fun. So nice. That's really solid for me. So I'm kind of getting back into it. I'm completely ignoring the story mode because it made me miserable when I was playing
PS4. Like, particularly replaying the story mode is not something I would wish on someone, for sure.
No. So I've been doing a lot of, you know, arcade mode, which is so good, and just random versus stuff, and it's really fun. I also should say the other reason I wanted this on Switch is that I wanted to play online more, and I have online access on Switch. I don't on PlayStation. PlayStation Plus is very expensive. Nintendo Switch Online is very cheap, and FighterZ is really the only game I own on PS4 I had any interest in playing online, so I think the Switch was better for it for me in that way, and, you know, as with any fighting game, your connection, like, it'll vary match to match, obviously. But I've had a little bit of fun there. I beat someone today. Sean online. And I came really close with another guy who was very good at Vegito Blue. And I got close. I got so close. I had all three of his fighters down to, like, the very end, but he was switching them a lot. And I don't know how you... There's some kind of super move you can do where all three of your fighters get in on a super attack. And I don't know how to pull that off.
Yeah, you're level one supers and you bring in your teammates?
I don't know how to do that.
Okay, all you have to do is initiate your level one super, so it's like quarter circle forward, R1 or R2 or whatever. And while that's happening, I don't know what the controls are on the Switch, but for PS4 where your teammates are tagged to L1 and L2, while you're performing the super, you hold down the tag button, and then the next person comes in and starts doing their super at the same time.
Okay, I will try that.
You can do three of them if you have enough meter for it.
Interesting. Okay, I will try that, because that is also kicking my ass in the hard versions of the arcade courses, which they mean hard when they say hard.
Okay. No, the hard arcade ladders can get fucked if you... Because it does that thing where if you do well, it you go up higher on the ladder and it gets more difficult. And I find it very easy to fuck myself by doing well in the early fights and to get to a point where it's like, oh, I just can't beat this person and I have to play it like 10 times.
Here's the one downside so far to getting it on Switch. And I had completely forgotten about this and didn't anticipate it. I forgot that Super Saiyan Blue, Vegeta, and Goku, you had to unlock them in the base version of the game.
Right.
But on day one on the PS4, they gave you a code for an early unlock. In the Switch, they're just locked, and you have to unlock them the default way, which is you have to beat those hard versions of the arcade courses with an A rank. Which,
fuck yeah.
I don't know if I'm ever going to do that. Now, you can also get them by getting enough Zenny in the game. If you get 300,000 Zenny, you get Vegeta. And if you get 500,000, you get Goku. I'm at 350,000 Zenny, so I've gotten Vegeta that way. And it'll take a while to grind to get Goku, because 200,000 of those Zenny was a gift the developers gave in, like, August or something for fucking up with the servers. I don't remember when, but it was just there for me. I have it on the PS4 version, too. So we'll see. There is also, if I really just cannot get Goku any other way, you can pay $2 in the eShop to get that unlock code. So, yeah. And I will say, I had not paid for any of the DLC on the PS4 version, so I don't have to rebuy any of that, but I am planning on. So today, Sean, we are recording this. It is Sunday. On Monday, tomorrow, I get my monthly paycheck, and I will be buying the Dragon Ball FighterZ Fighters Pack, because I did not have enough money for it before. I will tomorrow, and I need to play with Android 17 in his cool Universe Survival Arc look.
Yeah.
I really need it, and I'm excited to play with that pack. That pack also gets you Android 21 unlocked early, so you don't have to play the story mode, so that's great. But I did have enough money to buy one other piece of DLC, Sean. And I made the stupidest DLC purchase I have made since the War Horse in Red Dead Redemption 1.
okay, there's a couple of candidates of what this could be with Dragon Ball FighterZ, because there's a lot of DLC in that game.
There is a lot of DLC, but Sean, this week, the same week that I bought the game for Switch, they released Anime Music Pack 2.
Okay, yeah.
And Anime Music Pack 1 was something that appealed to me, but it also cost $15, which is absolutely fucking ridiculous. Like,
yeah.
This is DLC that should be free. Like, it should not cost you a dime. Like, this would be like if in Smash Bros. They were charging you to get Ridley's theme in the game or something. No, it should be completely free. They're charging you $14.99. There's 10 songs per pack. That's more than a dollar a song. It's ludicrous. These aren't even the full songs. They're like two-minute cutdowns. They don't even last an entire match. They have to loop. It's ridiculous. But, Sean, as me, this was the list of songs.
Yeah, I know. I saw it, too.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I couldn't resist. The list of songs was Chozetsu Dynamic and Genkai Toppa X Survivor, which is the theme songs to Dragon Ball Super. Yoka Yoka Dance, which is the worst Dragon Ball ending theme ever, so I don't know why that one's in there. That's not what made me excited. You get Dragon Soul, the theme to Dragon Ball Kai, but here's where we get good. We get Hero, Song of Hope, the insert song from Battle of Gods in that awesome scene where they use the insert song during the fight with Beerus. That's pretty cool. The best one, Unmei no Hi, is on here. This is the insert song when Gohan goes Super Saiyan 2 against Cell. It is maybe the best overall moment in Dragon Ball Z, just in terms of, like, direction and emotion and this fucking song. It's got the Ultimate Battle insert song from Dragon Ball Super. It's got, and then it's got four pieces of BGM from the original Dragon Ball Z run by Shunsuke Kikuchi. It's got the themes from the 8th Dragon Ball movie, the first Dragon Ball, or 8th Dragon Ball Z movie, the first Dragon Ball Z movie. It's got the Cell Games theme, and it's got the Fateful Deciding Battle theme, which is from the Saiyan era. And once I saw all of that, Sean, I just had to. I had to buy this and then start a match with Gohan and with Cell on the Cell Games arena and have it playing Unmei no Hi. And I think I cried a little because it was so perfect. And the game is definitely better with these songs. These songs should have been free. If they were paid, they should have been maybe $4.99 max. They were $14.99. It's a stupid amount of money I spent. But Sean, I'm down that rabbit hole. I was down that rabbit hole 10 years ago with spending stupid amounts of money on Dragon Ball. If I added up all the money I've ever made in life and I tried to find what percentage of the money I have accumulated in my existence on Earth I have spent on Dragon Ball, I'm not saying it would hit double-digit percentages, but I'm saying there might be a chance. So I just did it, and you know what? I'm having fun, because I can play, you know, online in a match and have it play the cool fight theme from Dragon Ball Z Movie 1, and have the fucking horns blaring, and feel like I'm playing original Dragon Ball Z, and I feel good, because the actual music in Dragon Ball FighterZ is pretty stupid, so this is great.
I just have to point out, Jonathan, that it is entirely possible to listen to that music without buying it for the game, especially when you probably own several pieces of that music anyways.
Yes, so, just a second.
Oh, Jonathan's going and grabbing something now.
I mean, Sean, I imported this soundtrack set from Japan. It cost me like $40 just so I could get all the themes from Dragon Ball Z, and Dragon Ball Kai, and Dragon Ball Super, what was out at the time. This is the Dragon Ball Kami Best 30th anniversary set. This is the special edition. It cost more than the actual CD. So yes, in fact, I have done that, Sean.
Yeah, so you just, instead of just being like, oh, I can put like some earbuds in, or I don't know how like the Switch music player stuff is, but for like PS4, I can just play it off of my PS4 and just turn the music off in the game and have all the sound effects work.
But
and
it's you just, do... But you wouldn't get Unmei no Hi with Gohan saying the line from the episode while he's looking at Cell. Like, it's so good. Like, it...
Because you just played the song when the match starts.
Yeah, but it's not mixed with the sound of the game. That's all I mean.
Okay.
It's not enough. You can't... If I put in headphones, I wouldn't be hearing the game.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm also saying about the music player. I don't know.
There's no such thing on Switch.
The PlayStation did just do it that way.
I didn't know the PlayStation had that, but
yes.
Still, it was. I don't want to say it was okay. It was worth it to me because I'm fucking stupid, Sean.
Okay,
stupid about Dragon Ball. To my right is my shelf with the entire English run of Dragon Ball, the entire Japanese run of Dragon Ball, and that's not even all the books. I have multiple copies of the color run of Dragon Ball in Japanese and in English, and in the other room I've got a shelf with the entire DVD run. I'm an idiot.
Yeah.
I'm an idiot. I'm in for a penny. I'm in for many, many pounds, and in this case, $14.99. Should you spend the money on this DLC?
No.
No. But I'm kind of glad I did.
Okay, quickly before we move on, since you brought up Anime Music Song Pack 2, did you watch the trailer they released for Anime Music Song Pack 2?
No.
For Dragon Ball FighterZ. Okay, you don't necessarily need to watch it right this second, but this is just a recommendation for the future and for listeners. They made a like 90-second long trailer using Dragon Ball FighterZ footage set to Genkai Toppa X Survivor, which is the opening for Dragon Ball Super that plays for the Tournament of Power arc, and it's sort of vaguely trying to replicate the visuals of that opening. Like, not exactly, but it has a couple of moments where it sort of visually quotes it.
I'm looking at it right now.
Yeah. It's fucking amazing, particularly when you get to, like, the very end of it. It's just... It's an amazing little piece of editing and really
it's
highlights...
Pretty good.
Dragon Ball FighterZ is a gorgeous goddamn video game.
Oh, yeah. And
so, yeah. People should check out that trailer.
You know, so we say the vertical integration of Dragon Ball really works on me, because when I'm watching Dragon Ball Super and I stop watching Dragon Ball Super, I really want to go play a Dragon Ball video game. And it just so happens that the best one ever made came out this year, and I can now play it anywhere on Nintendo Switch. They're going to get a lot of my money for this fucking game, Sean. That's what's going to happen.
Yep.
That's what's going to happen. Yeah. Again, they're not even the full versions of the songs. Like for Genkai Toppa X Survivor, there exists a 4-minute version of that song. I have it. Well, it's not on this set, but I do have it. But, you know, they could have put that on there. They put the TV-size version on there, which has to loop because fights in Dragon Ball FighterZ, unless you're really bad or really good, don't last 90 seconds. Even if you're really good, I don't think they last 90 seconds.
Yeah, there's three whole life bars to get through in a match of Dragon Ball FighterZ. It takes a bit.
Yeah. Unmei no Hi goes not as long as I would want it, but, you know, long enough to get the feeling for it. Yeah, so anyway... not worth it, but it is, you know, once a decade I get to spend stupid money on DLC. Generally, I'm pretty good about it.
Yeah, it's just $15 for a song pack is...
It's stupid. Ooh. It's really stupid. I mean, I remember, Sean, when J-Star's Victory Versus came out on the PS3. I think you played the re-release on the PS4.
Yes, J-Star's Victory Versus Plus.
Plus. Yeah, I imported it from Japan to play it, and on the PS3 it had this awesome feature where... Because the PS3 was much easier to put... That PS4 thing must be not new, but new-ish.
They added it like a year or so after the console came out. It's like the media player functionality. Yeah. It's a separate app.
Yeah, but PS3 had a really robust media ecosystem, and you could put your music on it. And for J-Star's Victory Versus, you could... It would just detect music you had in a certain folder, and it would just integrate it into the song library. So I could say, like, I put on there, like, all my Dragon Ball albums and some other music from some of the other series, and it just added it to the music player in the game seamlessly. That was so cool. Dragon Ball FighterZ obviously does not have that. They make you spend $15. So, there you go. All right, we've spent too much time on this. Let's move on. Sean, I'm going to say a couple things really quickly about Pokemon Let's Go.
Okay.
Which I am still loving. It is such a joy. It's a really good game. I don't think we have time to get into it today. It might be on my year-end list, and at the very least, we'll talk about it in that episode so I can say more nice things about it. But I do think everyone was afraid of the whole new catching mechanics thing. It is such a boon to Pokemon. It helps the pace so much. It's so much fun to play it that way. I think Pokemon Let's Go is mechanically a really, really sharp, fun game. But more importantly, Sean... This is a game where you can put Eevee in adorable hats. This is a game where you can put your character in adorable hats. You can give Eevee sunglasses. There are multiple styles of sunglasses you can buy for your Eevee, or your Pikachu if you go that way. It's really fucking fun on that level. You can also, when you get a Charizard, Sean, you can fly around on it. And I don't mean you can use fly. I mean you get on Charizard's back and just in the normal game. You can be in like Cerulean City flying around on a fucking Charizard. That's pretty cool, right?
Nice.
And you can, when you're surfing, you can get on Gyarados' head and just be way the hell up and surf around on Gyarados. And it is so much fun in that way. The different animations they've done, because every Pokemon in this game has a walking or flying or some kind of animation when they are out of the Pokeball. It is so adorable. It's so great. But I am here to tell you about the best one in the game. If you don't want to hear a spoiler, you know, don't listen to this part. When you get your Snorlax, because in the original Pokemon, remember, Snorlax is asleep and you get the flute and you wake him up.
Right.
Snorlax's walking animation is you, the person, and your partner Eevee are just holding on to Snorlax's belly as Snorlax walks around, like, kind of slowly, and Snorlax, like, slumbers around walking, and you're holding on to his belly. It is, that alone, Sean, gives Pokemon Let's Go a fighting chance for my top 10 list, because that is one of the biggest smiles I've ever had on my face playing a game.
That's pretty fucking good. That's really good.
You can do that, and then switch to flying around with Charizard, and then switch to having Venusaur lumbering behind you, which is really cool. It's a really good game. I would really stress, if you have any affection for Pokemon and you own a Nintendo Switch, I think this game is great for everyone. It's a really cool... It's a nostalgia trip, but it's a really, really good one.
So, awesome.
Yeah. And we'll say more about that later. But y'all know what we think about the original Pokemon games. They're good. This is like those. Only yes, you can ride on Snorlax's belly.
They have all the good Pokemon in this one. That's what matters the most.
Yes. All right, Sean, do you want to talk a little Hitman 2?
Let's talk a little bit about Hitman 2.
Have you
killed Sean Bean?
I have killed Sean Bean. I did it. It was the first elusive target I did successfully. Should we start there?
Yes, because honestly, I'm not super deep into Hitman 2 in the sense of that I've only played the Miami and Columbia levels, but I've played the shit out of those two, because I'm basically getting level 20 mastery before I move on, which I wasn't sure when I got Hitman 2 how I was going to do it. If I was going to, I'll play it a couple times and move on, or if I'll just do one and then go through all of them. And then I was like, no, I'm just getting level 20 mastery and then moving from that point. So I'm most of the way through Columbia. I have level 20 on Miami, and I killed the fuck out of Sean Bean. I also got the level 5 mastery whatever. I have all the challenges on the tutorial map.
Oh, nice. Fun. Yeah, I have not been playing it in that level of depth. I've seen more of the maps than you have. I today played the fourth map. Which is the one in the suburban town that was in all the trailers. I don't think that's a spoiler to say that.
No, yeah, I know what all the locations are.
Okay.
Yeah.
I have complicated feelings about Hitman 2 so far. It's good. If you liked Hitman 1, you should buy it. I'm not complicated about that. It's just I'm kind of in the same zone I was with Hitman 1 this time in 2016, where I'm just not sure how to play it. And I think it's partially because I have multiple other games I'm trying to play. My life is very, very, very busy outside of video games and podcast time, and so I don't feel like I have the time. Like, I think I would be enjoying this most if I did what you are doing and just made myself do level 20 mastery on each map before I moved on. And I've been getting to, like, level 11 or 12 mastery. I did that on the first two. The third map I wasn't so hot on, so I kind of moved past that to see what was next. And I don't know. I'm a little up and down. The ups are very high. It feels like this is one where I need to spend more time with it, because the maps are so big. They are ludicrously large. There's so far none of the smaller, more intimate maps a la a Colorado or a Hokkaido from the first one that are a little more dense rather than, like, these maps are both dense and really, really vast. Especially the third map is ridiculous. And there's, like, you know, multiple of them have more than two targets. The fourth map has two targets plus a kind of, to me, annoying extra thing you have to do every time that slows it down a lot. So, I don't know. I've always preferred Hitman, or this incarnation of Hitman, when the maps are a little more manageably sized and I can get my head around them. And this feels like it's almost too much game given to you all at once for me to, like, really know how to wrap my head around, because Hitman is so unlike every other video game out there for mostly good. That's a great thing about it. It is more like getting a giant toy box and you kind of decide how you're going to play with the toy box than it is it is a structured experience. I don't want to say it's not, but this is not a game where if you just play through the six levels, you're not going to be satisfied by it. You have to play with it more like a toy box. And I guess it's like, I got so many Lego pieces in the box this time, I'm not sure what to do with it. And I do find myself wishing, man, I wish this had come out episodically. And this month was just that first map in... What's the first map? It's Miami.
Miami. Yeah.
And if I just had Miami to play this month, and then, you know, in December, maybe in a couple weeks, we would get Columbia, and I would have several weeks where I could just think about Columbia. That would be so great, but it's all there at once, and it makes it a little tough for me to know quite what to do with it. That said, the game is hella impressive in so many different ways. And I'm sure, as you will tell us in a second, that if you put in a lot of effort into it and work with it, it probably rewards you in all sorts of cool ways.
No, it's fucking amazing. Yeah, like, Miami is such a good fucking map. And it was interesting because I wasn't... Like, I think probably the last time we talked about Hitman 2, I was a little bit, like, hesitant about Miami. I mean, I really liked it, but wasn't sure, like, you know, it's because it is way bigger than any of the, so is Columbia. I mean, Columbia is not, like, Columbia looks bigger than it actually is.
I will say this, Columbia I love unabashedly. I love everything about that map. It's so good.
Yeah. Yeah, but with, like, Miami, you know, you have, like, the whole Kronstadt military side of it, and you have the whole race side of it. And it, like, it really, I think I said this last time, it's like two Hitman maps put side by side and you kind of have to cross over and they influence each other a little bit. And that makes it a map that becomes so rewarding once you really learn how to navigate it well. And that's, I'm really glad that the Elusive Target was on that map because it meant that I got to play that. And then, as with every Elusive Target, because I got... Silent Assassin, because that's how I like to play the Elusive Targets, and that, like, forces you that fucking, like, second floor of that Kronstadt building that Sean Bean runs a, like, loop on in that Elusive Target, I know so well. I know that, like, better than I know the fucking streets around my house. At this point, you know, it's like, everything, every item, every character, every costume, every box, like, every key, like, everything in that, like one loop, I know perfectly. And then that made it that when I, after I did the Elusive Target, and I went back and, like, did a couple of the other challenges, and eventually I did Silent Assassin suit-only master difficulty on that map, because I came up with, like, what I thought was a really good way to do it. Turned out that it was a little bit harder than I thought it was going to be, and it took me, like, an hour to actually execute on, but the idea was fucking really good. Hard to do suit-only.
I did do Miami on master difficulty. I didn't do it suit-only, but I did it that way, and it was super fun. Like, it's a great way to, like, cap off one of these maps for yourself.
Yeah, because especially the main difference for me is that you can only make that one save, and so you have to really be, like... For me, it's you have to make your plan of what you're doing, and then I'm very adamant of every time I played Master, once you do the setup, you save at the end of the setup, and it's like, that way you just never have to do the, like, oh, I need to go over here and lockpick this thing and take this costume and get this key in and do all that stuff. Don't try to wait and make your one Master save at, like, the very end of something just to be safe, because then you're just doing setup over and over again. That's the kind of a lesson I had to learn in doing the Silent Assassin suit-only run, because there were a lot of restarts I had to do. But yeah, I just think the game is, like with Hitman 1, it's so rich, it's so dense. I'm having such a blast playing without all my normal tools because I still don't have, like, lethal poison unlocked. And so if I have to poison somebody, I need to go find some fucking poison. And it's been so long since I had to do that in Hitman because ever since I unlocked lethal poison files in, like, the Bangkok map or whatever one it is in Hitman 1, I've never had to go back to finding lethal poison. I just bring it in with me if I want to use it. And so, yeah, I'm just having an absolute blast. And the main thing I want to talk about is the Sean Bean thing, because that is, they put so much more effort into that Elusive Target. And I don't know if that's going to be a thing going forward with Hitman 2, or if that was just like, this is the first one. They've had more time to prepare for it. They got fucking Sean Bean. And it is like its own mission. It's basically, in some ways, even if they didn't change the geometry of the map, it feels as different as, like, one of the, like, holiday maps they did in Hitman 1, like the idol in, or the icon in those ones, because there's a whole mission opportunity, and there are multiple unique kills that only exist with the Sean Bean Elusive Target in, the weapon room and stuff like that, that I was so impressed and had so much fun trying to figure out how to do it.
Okay.
What did you do?
I'm going to tell you my Sean Bean story, Sean.
Okay.
Because I saw none of that.
Okay.
Because I sniped him in one shot. I never even heard his voice. I don't know what Sean Bean sounds like in this game, Sean, because somehow me, Jonathan Lack, the worst Hitman player, got a fucking sniper rifle in there. I shut that shit down. I got in that booth. I killed the two people who were in there. If I hadn't done that, I would have gotten, like, sniper assassin on this. And I fucking sniped him in one hit, and I did it! I did it! I did it. I couldn't believe I did it, but I did. I also sort of sabotaged my brother when he went to do it.
What did you do? How did you sabotage him?
I directly did nothing. But I watched Thomas doing it on his PC, and I was following and giving some little suggestions, and we decided, well, let's do that one where you go and go up to the person and you meet with them and they get you into the room with Sean Bean, right?
Yes, there's a whole, yeah, little setup where if you have the right costume on, you can talk to Mark Reddy, I believe his name is, and he leads you to the meeting because Sean Bean, this is such a great setup. Sean Bean's character is, it's basically the MI6 character or 006 character or whatever, where he's a disgraced former secret agent that has like turned assassin or whatever. And every time the ICA has killed him, he has come back. And so you have to kill him for good. And so that's the whole setup for the mission.
But anyway, so we got up there, and Thomas had brought... Thomas, I don't think, had ever done an elusive target, or he had never succeeded at one. I forget what it was. He was surprised to see, like, wait, if you die, you don't get to do it again? He didn't know that whole thing. So he was like, we were trying to decide what would be best. He was, like, uncomfortable with the sniping thing, so I said, well, you can bring in something, and you can put it, because there's that place. This is one of the most, like, convenient ICA drop-offs ever, is the magazine stand in the Kronstadt building.
So
he smuggled in a bomb, like a remote, not a proximity explosive mine. I said, that could come in handy. So he smuggled in that, he got into the room, and he was trying to figure out what to do, and I said, go see if you can drop that proximity explosive behind his chair. And he pulled it out. It was an illegal item, and he got shot immediately by the guards. And I'm sorry, Thomas. I'm not going to say I expected that to happen. I genuinely thought where you were standing, you would have a second to, like, reorient yourself. But I knew it was a possibility. And I feel both bad that I probably should have mentored you better at that level, but also it's kind of funny that that's how it happened. And he lost
It's totally his fault for fucking listening to your dumb ass. Like one, proximity explosives are fucking useless in Hitman. Just don't use explosives until you get remote detonated explosives. Never use the proximity ones. And then don't pull out a bomb in the middle of a crowded room, because that room is full of fucking people. There's like, especially if Sean Bean is in there, there's three guards in there. There's Mark Reddy, there's Sean Bean, and then there's like two normal staff people, and I think like a lady is in there. There's like 10 people in that fucking room. There are almost no blind spots unless you go all the way to the back in the middle of the presentation.
Yeah, this is part of why I did not fucking mess with that building and I tried to do the sniper thing. Yeah, Sean, can you believe I did the sniper thing, though, knowing me?
I mean, the only way I can envision you accomplishing the mission is by doing the sniping thing, because because sniping targets is basically the easiest way to kill them in Hitman, because you don't have to engage with, like, 90% of the game. As long as you find a decent sniping location, which this elusive target points you to, where you get a direct sight line, soon as you know the sight line, it's basically over.
It is. I'm amazed. I had A, the patience to wait for him to show up, and that I didn't just run out of the room and like go in there and just try to shoot him with an assault rifle, which is what I wind up doing a lot of the time in Hitman. And B, that I did pull off the precision. I just got him in the head in one shot. Because, you know, the sniper rifles are pretty easy to use in Hitman. I'm still pretty bad at it.
That's true.
Anyway, but I did it. Thomas did not. I'm sorry, Thomas. If you want to play on my PS4, you could use your account on my PS4 and you could play it that way and you could try it. You can't on your PC because you can only tie one account to your PC version because PC's weird. So there you go. But Sean, regale us. What did you do?
Yeah. So obviously I could have done the sniper one, but I didn't want to because I wanted to. If they put fucking Sean Bean in the game, I want to see Sean Bean in the game. I don't want to just shoot him from fucking a mile away and see his head explode. Yeah, I went through a couple of iterations. So with the elusive targets, this is the hot tip. This is how you are, like, supposed to play elusive targets. And it's basically the only way you could get Silent Assassin reliably is you can restart as long as you have not accomplished one of the objectives of the elusive target, which generally is just killing the elusive target. Sometimes there are, like, items you need to grab. Yeah, so, like, normally you should go... like, walk around, look at what, like, is going on, figure out what the pattern is, like, see what special items or things there are that they put in for the elusive target, figure out your sniper shot if you want to do sniper shots, and do all that without fucking anything up, because obviously if you die, it's over, but also if you complete one of the objectives, you are then locked in and cannot back out, or if you try to back out, you lose it. But before that point, as long as you're doing reconnaissance stuff, you can always replan the mission, like change your starting location, jigger with some stuff, go back in there and do something differently. So that's the only way you can basically get Silent Assassin. So I did a couple of different things of I think my original plan was I was going to try to poison his coffee with rat poison and drown him and stuff like that. And the fun thing about the Sean Bean one is they recorded quite a bit of dialogue with him. So if you're in that conference room that Mark Reddy takes you to and you sit down in the chair, eventually Sean Bean like basically sits down right in front of Agent 47 and has a whole conversation with him where he's like, hypothetically, because again, like the Sean Bean character is an assassin. He's just like, hypothetically, if you were to try to kill me right now in this room, what method would you use? And he's like trying to prove a point in the presentation. Of course, the writing of Hitman is always like, how can we get Agent 47 to make all these like puns and stuff about what he's going to do? And he like goes through all these scenarios of like, oh, I would poison your coffee and drown you in the toilet, or I would lure you out onto the balcony and push you over the side, the best one, and I almost wanted to do this just because it's so funny. At the end of that conversation, the last option you can pick as 47 is, or I could just take that kitchen knife and throw it into your skull, like one shot, you're dead, and it's a fun little conversation. But eventually that room is so crowded, I decided, trying to figure out how to shuffle around people in the room and move them out and like knock them out and find like a spot to hide them is too much. So instead I followed him around on his little loop. And in during that little loop, he has all these great conversations on his phone with his handlers where he knows that someone from ICA is after him. And they keep on talking around the fact of like, it might be him, you know, that one, if he's even real. And they're clearly talking about Agent 47, but don't have a name for him and all this stuff. And I'm like literally standing next to him, disguised as his bodyguard, walking with him while he's talking about like, oh, I hope he shows up. I hope he's real. I want to see what he can do. And it's like, I'm right here, you dumb idiot. But eventually what I decided on is there is a room that they have, like, there's the test room in the building that is kind of close to where the robots are that you can get the robots to shoot the main target in the mission. There's another room where all the scientist guys are, like, working on technology, and they kind of reconfigured that room with a bunch of different unique opportunities, like this bomb and all this stuff you can do in there. And one of them is the pin, because the story for the mission is that Sean Bean's character is here to get an explosive pin made for him so that he can use it in his assassination. And the scientist working in that lab, the pin is not explosive enough for him. And so it's all this stuff of like he's really upset and trying to get them to make this pin better. And one of the assassinations you can do is while he's inspecting this pin that is on this like pedestal on this like research lab desk, you can just take his head, slam it into the pin like it's fucking Joker from The Dark Knight, and like jab it through his eye and just kill him that way. As soon as I realized you could do that, I was set into that plan. So basically I just spent a lot of time shuffling around in that room, and there's a bunch of different rooms that he moves through near there that have boxes in them. So I would just like kind of lure one of the guards away just long enough to knock him out with a wrench, throw, or a fish, because I brought the fish in. So I slapped him in the face with the fish, threw guards in the box. Eventually, I knocked out the head research scientist, disguised myself as the head research scientist, and showed Sean Bean around the room as the head research scientist, describing all the items to him and getting to the pin, and then just talking about the pin and making, I forget what the dumb pun is, but you make some dumb pun, and as soon as he makes the dumb pun, I press the square button, take Sean Bean's head, slam it into the fucking pin on the table, and just walk away. And, mwah, beautiful. It was perfect. It was the perfect fucking assassination. It took me like an hour to set up and like figure out how to do it, but once it got set off, it was the best feeling in the world.
Awesome. Yeah, the Miami map is great. I think there's my favorite of the mission stories on that one is the one where you do it as the doctor and you put the poison in the IV. That one's friggin' just perfect. Yeah. I did do all the mission stories on Miami. I believe I did all the mission stories on Columbia. The third map is just kind of so big I got frustrated with it. The fourth map I'm really liking. Asterisk, there's an extra mission activity in that one that feels like busy work to me, and I think it messes up the pace. But it's a really cool... That fourth map, if it weren't for that, I think that fourth map is the best in the game so far. But I do want to talk a little bit about Columbia, because that one is so cool. Like, I don't know if you've had the same experience with it, but I've really loved Columbia, because it is... You're right. It seems bigger than it is, and I think it's because it is both big and dense. Like, I would say the closest analog to it for me is Sapienza, in that Sapienza also has, like, areas that feel so different. Like, Sapienza has that whole fucking underground part. It has the church part. Columbia has parts that, like, these barely feel like they're part of the same map, but I love that they are. And it's really interesting to explore, and I've had fun getting lost in that one. I think if I have had any... Because the thing about Hitman is, like, figuring out how you're going to play it, you know?
Yeah.
And I think you've played a lot more of Hitman than I have. I've played a lot of Hitman. You've played a lot of Hitman. And it's, what is it, your fifth favorite game of all time? Where did you have it?
It was somewhere in there. Yeah.
So, and you're obviously top game of 2016. So, you know, I still sometimes struggle with, like, especially when, again, they just gave you the entire six-course meal all at once. And I'm like, oh, where the fuck do I start? This is all dessert, basically, is
right,
what it
yeah.
is. And I did, I think, the most fun I had was I made, on the fourth map, instead of trying to go after mission stories, which feel a little too guided for me sometimes, because they take some of the surprise out of it, and I don't know if you have any suggestions about that, I just decided, I'm just going to go for it. I'm going to forget about all the challenges, all the mission stories. I'm just going to just go on instinct. And I wound up doing it, like, without a single costume change, just kind of having fun with it. I didn't get it, like, the challenge for it, because at the end I took out a machine gun and shot seven people or something.
Okay. So it was still you playing Hitman. Okay.
It was still me playing Hitman. That was after I'd killed the targets. But anyway, and I had a lot of fun like that, just kind of figuring it out as I went along. And it was cool. And then I did it a second time doing some mission stories. And I have an idea of how I could do it Silent Assassin, but I'm gonna need some of that poison, Sean, so I have to get my mastery up a little more. So anyway, I am definitely having fun with it. I do think, and I know you don't have to follow the mission stories like point by point by point. It does feel sometimes like when I'm doing them that it gets a little too paint-by-numbers for me. And it is, the game does seem at its most fun in the elusive target kind of scenario where you really have to piece it together for yourself.
Yeah, I think, like, the best way to look at the mission stories are, because I tend to just go through them all so far in both Miami and Columbia. I've just gone through them all, like, one after the other. Because they are a good way that they take you to most of the main locations in the map, and they show you some of, like, the main kind of special mechanics in the map. So there's, you know, some of the weird stuff you can do with the race, that there's a lot of things you can do to fuck with that race in the Miami map. But two of the mission stories sort of introduce you to, this is one way you could fuck with this race, and from this point you could spoke off and do a bunch of other different shit if you weren't trying to do the specific mission story. So I kind of see the mission stories that way of, like, if you want, it's a good little teaser for what you can do on the map, but the real game starts once you, as you said, like, you kind of, like, off the leash, you're trying to figure out what you want to do. I typically use, like, the challenges as a guide, because there are lots of challenges that are not mission story challenges that, like, are other unique ways to kill people. Like, there's a whole thing with, like, poisoning the shot glass in Miami, or I think maybe the best assassination in Miami is the one for the challenge that has you have to kill both the dad and the daughter, Robert Knox and Sierra Knox, at the same time by pushing Robert Knox onto the racetrack. Getting that one to happen, I will say that, like, using that was the linchpin of how I got my Silent Assassin suit only run, which is, like, that is more difficult than, once you figure out how to do it, it seems like, oh, that'll be super easy. There are more complications of that than I realized. But those kinds of things, once you're off of the mission stories, are so much fun, because there is no option of the, just point me directly at the thing that gets me to go him, to move him to this spot. But there are, like, you know, items and different manipulables in the environment that they put in to do all these other kinds of activities. I just see the mission stories as the sort of appetizer, and then once you're through that, you really dive into it.
You want me to tell you quickly about something I fucked up in a very Jonathan way on
ahead.
On the fourth map?
Uh-huh.
I'll talk around it so I don't spoil anything for you. But on the fourth map, there is an opportunity that you can get really early on for a mission story, because it's like a booth that's right there when you start up. And there's a vendor, and there's another guy, and there's something you're going to do with the vendor and the other guy. And the mission story starts and says, you need to get this one guy's costume. And I see that, and there's the vendor and two people there at the booth, and I'm like, well, how do I get these two people away so I can get the vendor? There's some bushes nearby where I could hide the vendor's body, so if it's just me and the vendor, I could do this pretty easily. The other two people weren't going away, so finally I took out my silenced pistol and just shot all three of them. And then as I was dragging one of their bodies into the grass, a woman across the street saw me, a jogger. I had to shoot her in the face, drag her body into the... Anyway, this ended with me dragging 8 bodies into the bushes. I just, like, dragged half of the fucking neighborhood into the bushes. But I did get the guy's costume. And then the mission story didn't go quite right, and I couldn't quite figure out what it wanted me to do. Only today, later, did I realize it's because I needed one of those people to be alive.
Oh.
The story. So
that will complicate things, yeah.
That would complicate things. Anyway, I have a video of this, Sean, that I will upload at some point that I made on the PS4 with the share button. So, anyway, that's Hitman 2. We will have many more stories from this game. Anything else before we move on?
It's a good game. I'm sorry, Sean Bean, but you are dead as fuck.
Yep.
He had a pin through his fucking eyeball.
And I shot him square in the face.
There you go. Two dead Sean Beans, one podcast.
Two dead Sean Beans, one very alive Sean Bean in Thomas's run of the game. Sorry, true. Thomas. All right, let's go ahead and move on to Red Dead Redemption 2. To recap Red Dead Redemption 2, where we have gone so far, I played the game sort of focusing on the story more than anything, although I did a lot of the open world stuff. It probably took me like a good 60 hours to complete the game. I ran a little hot and cold on it on the beginning until a certain thing happened in the story, and then I played the rest of it very invested and cried a lot playing a Rockstar game, which I never thought would happen. You played Red Dead Redemption 2 extraordinarily slowly and took like 2 weeks for every chapter until, I don't know, at some point you... how long did it take you to finish like chapters 5 and 6 in the epilogues?
5 and 6 was pretty quick. The epilogue, I mean, I would have been able to finish the epilogue in like 2 days, but I had so much school stuff that I actually finished the epilogue, I think, 2 days ago.
Okay.
But that was mostly because there was like 5 days or something where I kind of didn't have time to do anything else.
Yeah.
Because actually, honestly, I finished chapter 4, I think, the day after we recorded the last podcast.
Okay.
Which was like 2 weeks ago. So it was like right after Thanksgiving-ish, I think is when I think it actually was the Friday after Thanksgiving was when I finished chapter 4. And then past that, I kind of blazed through chapter 5 and 6 because that is when, well, particularly chapter 6 is where the story kicks into high gear and the thing you're talking about happens. And I was like, oh, okay, like shit has changed. I need to see this story to conclusion. And I really liked that. And I, to give my, like, now spoiler-free thoughts before we dive all the way into it, because, you know, we haven't talked since I finished the game. I love it to death. All the shit I loved before, I still love, you know. I just think the expressiveness of the gameplay and the detail and density of the world is absolutely incredible. And the story, while it takes a long time to get there, and I have mixed feelings about how necessary some of that stuff was, once it gets to where it is trying to go, it is like a Persona 3 or a Nier Automata in the sense of once it gets into that last act and it like sets all the pins up and it's ready to go, the whole game changes in those final hours. I mean, it's like hours and hours. It is a long section of the game. But once like, it is that thing of like, there's chapters 1 through 4 and like, kind of like where you see the split off with chapter 5 can maybe is different. But, like, definitely, that's one game. Once you get into Chapter 6, that's, like, a different Red Dead Redemption 2. Not in a bad way, in an amazing way.
It's like January in Persona 3 or the last couple runs in Nier Automata. It's, yes, I think that's a perfect comparison. I thought the epilogue was meh. I don't know about you.
I think your description of the epilogue feeling like a piece of DLC that would have come out, like, a couple months later, but just being at the end of the game is pretty spot on. Like, I enjoy it for... There's stuff in it I like... But
it's way too long for what it is.
It is too long, and it feels like it probably would have benefited in some ways for if I had more distance from the main story before I played it. But I also knew it would have been hard to go back to the game with all the other shit I need to do. So I was just like, no, I need to go through the epilogue and kind of had to like make some momentum for myself. But once I got into it, I enjoyed it. But it is definitely like. It is not a smooth transition like the epilogue in Red Dead Redemption 1 is. It is like, there's like a whole small game here at the end.
Yeah, it's... Like, I don't know why they don't roll credits before the epilogue. It's weird.
Yeah.
Well, okay, it's because the credits are 40 minutes long. I don't know why they don't roll partial credits, let's say that.
Right.
Anyway, all right. spoiler-free thoughts are done. We are now going to spoil the ever-living shit out of Red Dead Redemption 2 in 3, 2, 1. Arthur gets tuberculosis, and I had a moral awakening, Sean. Not just me playing Arthur Morgan, I mean me, Jonathan Lack, in the world, thinking about life and death far more deeply than I should playing a goddamn video game. Arthur gets that diagnosis, and at that point in the game, I had, as I said, been a little hot and cold on it. There was the whole, I feel like chapters 3 and 4 and parts of 5 get into narrative cul-de-sacs that are not nearly as bad as the narrative cul-de-sacs in GTA 5 or in GTA 4 or even in Red Dead 1, like the Mexico stuff. But they felt a little cul-de-sac-y to me, and we were kind of going in circles. And I wasn't sure what I was thinking about the game, and I had a very low honor because I was just kind of fucking around with the game. And then Arthur gets tuberculosis, Sean, and he starts thinking about what his life has meant. And the game pulls the entire weight of its giant open world and all the things you can do in it and all the things you maybe haven't done in it. And it pulls this massive thing together to give you the opportunity at some level of redemption within the moral universe of this game. And I went after it, and I leveled up my honor all the way, and I made friends with a guy in the North Country, and he died, and I got his horse, and that horse died at the end of the game. Buell fucking died, and I fucking cried, and I have a whole essay I wrote about that I'm going to share on the year-end podcast, because I just know that's what I need to say about it. And I met this widow up in the North who I helped. And I think the thing that hit me hardest, and I think this is one of the best pieces of narrativizing I have ever seen in a video game, in terms of closing that gap between player and character, is when I realized where Arthur got the tuberculosis. That where he got it is from one of the people way early in the game. This is like chapter 2 stuff, right?
Yeah, it's in chapter 2.
It's in chapter
2. It's like at the beginning of chapter 2.
Yeah, where you're going and doing all of the debtor's stuff for... Is it Strauss is the debtor?
Yes.
Johann Strauss. And so you're doing all the debtor stuff, and there's this just one random guy who had tuberculosis, and you beat him up, and because of the way I played the game, I killed him. And
you
don't have to do that, but I fucking killed him. And the game will change. It will adapt for that, depending on how you play. And I realized, not only had I gotten it there, I had to look it up, Sean, because I didn't remember that guy. I didn't remember the name they were mentioning. I didn't remember it. And I looked it up and I realized, I was so fucking evil. I did this. I tore this family apart and I didn't remember it. And while I'm thinking that, Arthur Morgan is thinking that. And Arthur Morgan is thinking, this didn't even leave an impression on me at the time, because I did so much shit like this. And I know my Arthur Morgan was more extreme than your Arthur Morgan, but that is the general arc of the game. And I felt... And there is a direct narrative thing in the game where you can go to this man's widow or his remaining family. Because I think he dies either way, right?
Yeah, he dies of tuberculosis, whether or not you brutally murder him like you did.
Yes. Whether or not he dies, and you can go help his widow and his son. And that is one amazing narrative line, but it's only one part of how I fell in line with Arthur Morgan, the character, and the amount of space Red Dead Redemption 2 gives you in that final push to express yourself, not just in a cowboy dress-up mode, not just in a fun Western shoot-em-up mode, but in the mode of having a true moral awakening and making some small attempt at penance in a broken, broken world. No video game has ever done that. No video game has ever attempted that. I've never seen a video game do anything remotely like that. The closest analogs would be something like Persona 3 or Nier Automata that absolutely make you think existentially about life and death. But I think in the very particular way they do it in Red Dead Redemption 2, where they tie it so specifically to morality, where they make that morality meter for the first time in a video game more than just a gimmick.
Yeah.
My God. And again... I'm sure you get this, Sean, before our listeners. For me, Jonathan Lack, to play a Rockstar game and end that game with max level honor, where by the end of it, I wasn't even shooting at people in missions if I could avoid it. I wasn't shooting at cops when they came after us. I was like trying to be the best person I can be. That is an immense impression that this game left on me. Immense. And just talking about it again, I'm feeling all choked up again, because there are moments of beauty in this game that are so transcendent. When I say it allows you to express yourself, I mean it's through every level of it. Like, that the horse I was using was Buell, and that I was not shaving and I was wearing hobo clothes the whole time because I felt like that's what I deserved. Like, I was going out on almost on a, like, I was being an apostle kind of thing, where I'm like not thinking of myself. I'm really going out and living this, like, you know, a life free of all these things. Like Arthur is giving away all his money. I ended the game with no money left because Arthur gave all of it away to people. It is crazy to me how much this game worked me over, Sean. It's a goddamn masterpiece. And I was maybe hesitant to say that a few months ago, knowing where we were a couple years ago with another big Rockstar game that people foolishly called a masterpiece but wasn't. This one fucking is.
Yeah, no, I agree. And it's interesting because, like, I think my path with it was somewhat different in terms of, like, what the... Since I was high honor anyways, like, what the tuberculosis thing did for me was really interesting. Of, like, the way that it helped, like, me contextualize and narrativize the manner in which I was had been playing the game up to that point, which is now well documented on this podcast, of I was all over the place and I was constantly, like, for me, like, Arthur was this guy who was kind of constantly finding an excuse to fuck off for, like, a week. And it's like, I'm going to go to the mountains. Like, there's a legendary beaver, like 5 miles that way. I'm going to just take a trip. You guys seem cool. Everything is settled right now. I'm going to go hunt this beaver. And I'll probably, like, discover a weird buried treasure in a poison cave. Maybe I'll find a serial killer. I don't know. Like, I'm going to go have adventures. And I was, like, so freewheeling and just, like, playing poker with weird dudes. And just, like, you know, just living my best cowboy life. Because, you know, the story missions are very Rockstar in the sense that they are typically very, very constrained in what they allow you to do. I'm typically fine with that. I don't chafe against it the way that a lot of people do. But I was constantly, like, feeling that push and pull between I'm enjoying the story stuff, but also there's this vast, incredible open world for me to explore and see and experience. And so for me, Arthur was this guy who's kind of like, he is already kind of at his wits end with the gang by the beginning of the game. Like, there's already the tension between him and Dutch is very clear. It's very clear that, like, you know, when people like Micah started coming into the gang, that things went wrong and that Arthur feels sort of out of place, even if he cares about these people and is in his own way the moral center of the gang. Like he can't just be there all the time because his relationship with Dutch is so destructive in many ways. And that's kind of how I felt and how I was kind of playing the game and using that as an excuse to go off and explore. And then when you get back from Guarma and all the tuberculosis stuff happens, it was this moment for me of like, oh shit, like, even if in the game you technically have unlimited time, it feels like, oh, my time is limited. Like, I need to prioritize the stuff that matters, and I have been spending so much of my time doing whatever the fuck I wanted, even if I wasn't going out and murdering people. I mean, it's hard to, you kind of can't play Red Dead Redemption 2 without being a bad person to a certain extent because you are an outlaw. But I wasn't wanton murder Jonathan style, just going out and slaughtering people and brutally murdering the guy who has tuberculosis just because I can. You know, I wasn't going that far with it.
I mean, Sean, this is what scars me. I don't remember how I killed him. I don't know if I throttled him. I don't know if I shot him. I don't know how brutal it was. And I can never know. And that's why I gave all my fucking money away, because it was this one small piece of good I could do in a world I helped to break.
Yeah, and for me, it was this, like, I need to, like, these are the people that matter to me. It is this gang, and it is, like, I need to spend my time with them and try to make things better, which is, like, what the story is in the game. And I love all the stuff of, like, Arthur. There's this couple of missions that Arthur and John have together in that stretch where he's, like, kind of, like, feeling out. It's like, when shit goes bad, you get out of here. You ride and you don't look back, because we're in us who changed. Like, all that stuff, all those scenes it's are perfect.
The evolution John Marston goes on in this game is worthy of its own podcast, because it's the most interesting he is in either game to me. Weirdly.
Yeah, it's that stuff's amazing. All the, like, extra stranger missions near the end, like the one with the veteran by the lake and the widow up in the mountains, like, those are so fucking good. And then I also was, like you, I went I didn't go full hobo in terms of the clothes necessarily. I, like, you know, it was cowboy, so it was all dusty anyways. But I went full, like, let the beard go, let the hair go.
You were making fun of me about this last time.
Well, that's because you were doing it all the time, and you're probably your
Arthur's No, I hadn't terrible. Been. I hadn't been. I had grown a beard earlier, but I had been doing, like, for a long time in the game, I had a very cut look where I did a Bryan Cranston from Breaking Bad, where I was bald and had a long goatee. But, and I was keeping that up, like, for a while. Mm. It was, and I let it go after Guarma, and after learning about the tuberculosis.
Yeah, because I had a, like, fairly, like, I had, I think, swept back hair, and then just would let the beard grow out a bit, and then once it got to, like, level 3 or 4, would shave it back again. Because usually it would be by the time I was back from one of my excursions, it was time for a shave. But after coming back from Guarma, you have a beard and longer hair anyways, because of the time narratively is spent in between those two sections, and I just kind of kept that. I didn't let my beard go, like, I think I kept my beard at level 5. I didn't let it, because it's like, at a certain point, it's just like, you can't see his face anymore.
I dyed at level 8.
Okay, yeah. So, I assume the last cutscene of the game is just a shot of his beard silhouetted against the sunset or sunrise.
It's not quite that ridiculous. It's honestly, I'm pretty impressed by how the animation holds up at the higher beard levels. But
yeah, it looks good. And then the longer hair. And it was... If I had to describe the aesthetic of my Arthur Morgan at the end, it very much was a, like, what if Jeff Bridges was in True Grit when he was in The Big Lebowski? Like, that age Jeff Bridges, but Rooster Cogburn from True Grit. It's like, it's a very particular hair, but, like, particularly if you pomade the hair, it's got a real Jeff Bridges look, and I like that a lot. But yeah, I went with that and lived my best cowboy life. And maybe one of my favorite details of just, like, how this kind of worked out with the cowboy dress-up and things I was playing with the look of the character that worked so fucking perfectly that, like, helped, like, contextualize and narrativize things for me that just, like, you know, because it just things kind of worked out that way, was I was sort of trying to figure out the look of my Arthur in terms of his clothes now that he was getting more ragged like this. And there's one of the coats I think that you start with is one of the winter coats you have called the Montana coat. And it's this really good looking, like this is like in like a Western TV show, the hero wears this coat kind of coat. It's just like this, you know, it's not like luxurious, but it's very distinctive. It's a unique piece of clothing. It's not color swapped like all the other pieces of clothing were. And I kept on trying to find an excuse in the story to get Arthur to wear this coat and could never quite find it. And it was in that last chapter where there were these moments where I was like, Arthur is starting to kind of become a good person, really, for the first time in his life, like, actually properly being good and trying to do good. And so there were, like, a couple of missions where I was like, I'm going to try out this, like, hero coat looking thing. Like, he looks like a Western hero from a movie or something. And then where it worked really well was the mission where Eagle Flies gets sort of stoked by Dutch and attacks the oil plant. And then you have to ride after and try to save everybody because shit's going crazy. And it's this big, crazy whole action set piece. And I ride in with my awesome coat and my cool hat and all this shit. And then at the end of that mission, you pass out because you're coughing so hard from tuberculosis, get covered in mud, and you're saved by, like, the German couple you help way earlier in that game, finding one of the, I think, the Chapter 3 hideout. And after that point, it was like, oh, I have to hang up the hero coat because it's all muddy and gross, even if it doesn't technically stay on there in the game. It was like, I have to switch clothes. I have to get out of this because it's too late for Arthur to become a hero. And it was like that realization for me of, like, what I was trying to role play with, like, the clothing is this realization that's like, no, like, it's too late for him. And it was like, I just put on, I think, like, the buckskin hunting jacket and his classic Arthur hat. And it was just like, dressed fairly plainly because it's like, I was trying to explore that space of, like, he's a good version of Dutch because that Montana coat kind of looks like a, like, white version of Dutch's black clothes that are very sort of lavish. It was like too late for Arthur to be a hero. Have to hang up the muddy coat and live the moments he has left the most honest way he can.
There's a mission near the end of this game that I think is the best thing Rockstar has ever done. This whole section is, but this specific mission is my favorite mission in a Rockstar game, where you are with the Indian chief.
Rainfalls,
yeah. Played by Graham Greene in a just spectacular performance. Not that Graham Greene is capable of giving a less than spectacular performance, but a particularly spectacular Graham Greene performance. and you are just following him along, and you basically go over a mountain together, and you just look at the scenery, and you talk about life and death, and you can choose what to reveal and what not. This is where Arthur, if you choose, talks about having a kid at one point, which is never mentioned elsewhere, to my knowledge. Maybe it is optionally, but to my knowledge, is not brought up anywhere else in the game. You can bring it up here. You kind of have this unburdening with this man who gives you wisdom, but also just humanity. There's so much empathy in the mission, in, you know, this chief who owes you nothing, just being kind and trying to help you manage this illness, and talking about, you know, opportunities missed and mistakes made. And at one point, you find out that there's a sacred ceremonial place that has been raided and something has been stolen, and you can go get that back. And it was the first time I really heavily approached a mission from a complete point of nonviolence. I didn't even try to use guns, and I had to try a couple of times because this is not a stealth game. You know, this is not Hitman. Yeah. Hitman, you have to try a couple of times. This one, you really have to if you're going to be stealthy about it. But I did it, and I got it back to him, and it is the first time in a Rockstar game where I had truly... It felt like the most grown-up I've ever seen Rockstar be, where Red Dead 2 does have a significant problem of mission design being too formulaic around shooting. And I think there are things that I think are contextualized by the end of the game, and I think there are things that are still problematic. I do think that mission design is still problematic, even if other parts are contextualized. But this is a mission where it's just about being in the world and relying on their amazing capacity for art and amazing vistas and for character and for writing. And it felt like putting their powers to their absolute best good. And that mission just hit me like a ton of fucking bricks. And there are maybe more overtly powerful moments later on. The entire last hour or two, when it's just, you're swept up in, like, there's, they do the thing where Arthur is riding back to camp and music plays, and it is an incredible moment. They leverage that very well in this game. But that mission, more than anything, just, wow, it knocked me flat. And I think in general, you know, there's a conversation to be had that we should have about the way the game appropriates different cultures under the, like, outlaw visage that I think is problematic in a lot of ways, because I think Rockstar over romanticizes the whole outlaw lifestyle, and I think it underrepresents these other identities that it co-opts. But I think it meets pretty nicely in the middle with the section on the Native Americans, because it lines up so much with Arthur's dying and Arthur really having to be a creature of empathy at this point. And he's the only one who really actually seems to care about the Native Americans just as people. And I think that is done well there. And it is such a human level of storytelling that I don't think, like, the Black or Irish characters really get in the game to the same degree. You know, it's still imperfect, but I think that one works really well. And I wanted to highlight that mission because, boy, it really all comes together for me there.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree with you. And the thing I want to dive into more, because I think it's really interesting about this game, is that stuff of, like, the romanticizing of the outlaw life and, like, what is the game saying about it? Because there's a part of me that's like, this game is saying that, because there's a part of me that feels like this game is saying that all past Rockstar games, except for maybe GTA 4, which is very cynical, are kind of bullshit. Because, like, Dutch Vanderlyn is the protagonist of a normal Rockstar game and of a normal GTA game, it feels like to me.
Oh, yeah.
In another scenario, you're playing as Dutch, and you're the guy who's, you know, talks a mile a minute, like, every fucking mission you're on, you know, like John Marston in Red Dead Redemption. I like John in Red Dead Redemption 1 a lot, but every fucking mission in Red Dead Redemption is John giving a sarcastic response about how everybody else around him is wrong, and, like, going on and on about the American dream, and blah, 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 and, like, all that. And he's just, you know, it's every fucking mission in those games.
They're obnoxious, like, libertarians. That's every other Rockstar protagonist.
Yeah, and they're just, they are these mouthpieces that are constantly talking about philosophical bullshit, but they have, it's not full South Park, but they have a South Park-esque, like, because they're speaking from a place of negating other things, they kind of don't stand for anything themselves. And again, I think John is probably the best example of, like, I still like John Marston in Red Dead Redemption 1. Most other Rockstar characters, particularly any of the characters in fucking GTA 5, particularly Michael and Trevor, terrible. And, like, they don't, they, like, Michael and Trevor are full fucking South Park territory of, like, they stand for nothing, they mean nothing, they represent nothing, they're just angry and deny everything around them because that's the only quality they have to them. And so that's sort of the typical Rockstar protagonist thing. And Dutch Vanderlyn is that guy. He's the guy who's always denying everything around him. He's constantly saying something vague about, like, oh, the freedom of America and civilization is not real freedom and blah, blah, blah. And it's such fucking horseshit. And this is, like, the first Rockstar game that I feel like understands that's all horseshit. Like, Dutch is a sociopathic asshole. And he's been manipulating everybody the whole fucking game. He has no real center. There's, like, no real ethic behind him. Like, everything is this, like, vague outlaw code that he's built up. But there's, like, one of the things that Arthur and John talk about in that last section of the game is how much of what has been happening to Dutch that, like, could be seen as Dutch changing is actually us seeing Dutch for what he is for the first time. And I very much lean in the Dutch has always been this.
Oh, yeah.
He's always been like this, and it's just like the other people in his life have kept it so, like, he hasn't gotten this extreme. But, like, since Micah is there as, like, a Iago-type figure that's sort of spurring him on a little bit and is, like, making it feel like, oh, it's okay, Dutch, for you to be your true self or, like, to, like, really let things go. Once, like, you know, limiting influences are away from Dutch Vanderlyn, this is the kind of fucking, like, betraying, like, no good, stands for nothing, bullshit, outlaw, murderous piece of shit he has always been. And he has just duped everybody else in the gang to follow him because that's the kind of guy he is he's the guy who talks, but he doesn't actually stand for anything. And Arthur Morgan is the kind of guy who is not a very good talker, like, can't talk himself through fucking any situation. But he is brutally honest and earnest and genuine and is trying to stand for something, even if for most of the game he doesn't really know what that is. And it's that contrast for me makes me feel like, I feel like this game is saying that, like, the romanticization that Rockstar has participated heavily in the past, but most Western fiction participates in romanticizing the West and romanticizing the outlaw life, that's all horse shit. And it's like, it's not about being this hero, outlaw, Robin Hood figure. It's about trying to be a good person. And generally speaking, being a good person doesn't involve robbing and murdering.
Yes. And again, I think there are some points where how the game kind of views, like, that the gang's relationship to marginalized groups and how much they do or don't bring that into the gang identity feels a little problematic to me. But I think the overall sweep, I completely agree with. I mean, and I absolutely do think there is something metatextual about it, where when I say this game feels like Rockstar growing up, it's because in the text, it feels like exactly what you're saying. Dutch Vanderlyn is the first time they've shone the spotlight back on themselves, it feels like, you know, and said, yeah. Like Trevor in GTA 5 is not an analysis of anything. And I was so annoyed by the criticism at the time of, like, no, Trevor is a commentary on bip, 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 bip. No. He's nihilism, and he's just a force of nihilism, and it's an excuse for Rockstar to just get their rocks off with different pieces of violence, and that's all that is. And Michael stood for nothing in that game, and third guy, Franklin, stood for nothing in that game. And it's kind of all there is to that, and I think Red Dead 1 has spikes where it gets more towards saying something, but there's also a lot of riding around, and as you say, John just sarcastically, it is that South Park syndrome of, we have no ideology, our ideology is, you know, tearing down other people's ideologies and laughing at you for caring about things. And Red Dead Redemption 2 is about, in the end, caring about something so much you will give every piece of yourself to see some little piece of that realized. You know? That, yeah. John Marston is not that important, but Arthur Morgan is going to fucking die and give up every piece of wealth and everything he has built in life so that this guy can go maybe have a life with his wife and kid, you know? And maybe Sadie will get away free, and maybe some of the people he saved in the gang can get away okay. He will do everything he can for that. And it is such a turn from the other Rockstar games. And I also don't think it would be as powerful if I hadn't been playing those other Rockstar games for a decade plus at this point and been inundated with that. Because I agree, GTA 4 is probably the closest they've gotten to it at this point. But GTA 4 is still fundamentally very nihilistic. Like, its ultimate point about the American dream with, like, the split ending where he's doomed either way, Niko Bellic is interesting. But it ultimately comes back to just a point of, it's all shit, you know? Like, right. I could see Niko Bellic 5 years after the end of GTA 5 being an Arthur, or being a Dutch Vanderlyn type figure. Like, that would be his superhero, supervillain origin story, you know? Of realizing nothing mattered. And Dutch Vanderlyn is a great character because he is a really interesting, critical interrogation of that entire philosophy and that entire character type. And it really is done very well in this game. I mean, they play it like it's a cult, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, that's the word I keep coming back to with Dutch Vanderlyn is it's a cult, and what happens to Arthur is he's deprogrammed from it, you know? And it's,
because particularly for Arthur, like, he was, like, 13 or 14 when Dutch found him, and, like, Dutch taught him how to read, and all, like so many of the people in the gang were taught by, well, no, actually, probably Hosea probably taught Arthur how to read, but Arthur, because Dutch talks such a good game, Arthur thinks it's because of Dutch, even if it's really Hosea, because Hosea is really the one that's kind of helping everybody, but Dutch strikes this, like, very convenient figurehead, and so many people are inculcated by that at such a young age.
It is very cult-like, and it is, the dissolution of the gang is so wrenching in the last act of this game, even when you know it's coming. Again, this is Heat in the Old West, just with the big robbery done 27 times, not once, in the middle of the movie. And the way they do it, with when I say the game at the end pulls the strings together of all of its different systems, it's because, like, it would not have the power it has if you didn't have the gang as a mechanical system in the game that was there at the base, and you go there, and you talk to them, and you live there, and you return there for all of the different missions, and you go to sleep, and you shave, and you have parties with them, and all these different things, and the world just feels so alive outside of you that when that part of the world just dies one painful step at a time, it really has an impact.
Yeah, and one of the things it made me think about, because I finished this game right after we recorded our last podcast where we talked about Dragon Quest XI, wherein probably my major criticism of Dragon Quest XI was that it's a game, not to spoil anything for people who haven't played it yet, but, like, it's a game that in its, like, epilogue section bends over backwards to try to make sure that it never takes anything away from the player, that everything that has been taken away is given back to the player at some point. One thing that makes Red Dead Redemption 2 so powerful is it definitively does not do that, and it progressively takes things away by either killing characters, taking away storylines. Like, you can miss entire story missions or, like, stranger missions and stuff if you don't do them within a certain time frame. Like, and they are just gone, and it will then all, you know, it ultimately takes that whole camp system that you have been contributing to and, like, funding and getting your upgrades from and stuff. It takes that whole system and it takes that away from you in the end. And it's, like, bit by bit. In Chapter 6, the camp is fucking useless. Like, you can't... I don't even think you can donate money to it anymore. It's, like, it's just utterly falling apart because nobody really has the will to keep the camp together anymore. And it just takes away all that shit. And you can't have it. Like, you can't do it.
Yeah. In psychoanalysis class, the psychoanalysis class I'm in, which I've talked about before on this podcast, the professor has worked a lot with video game theory and writes about that. And we were talking about, there's a theory in psychoanalysis about, like, the tether fantasy, which is, as in all psychoanalysis, it's tied to something in the fucking womb. But it's the idea of, like, the umbilical cord, but how you can kind of tie that to the places where we tether ourselves in the world. And he's written a lot about how video games do this in all sorts of different ways. One of the examples he showed was, like, Minecraft, you know, the first night trying to build a little house for yourself and then going past that, and that's always your, like, tether back to the world. And Minecraft maybe gets boring after you have no need for a tether because you've built five castles.
Right.
Red Dead Redemption 2 is a great candidate for this kind of theoretical reading because of the camp and because of where it gives you a tether and where it takes it away from you and just rips the rug out from under you. Slowly and achingly, but it does rip it out from under you. And I think it utilizes that so intelligently in the last act of this game. And I have problems with the epilogue. One thing I like about the epilogue is it does not recreate that. It gives you different access to it, but it does not, like, John does not now have a camp system at the end of Red Dead Redemption 2. And I thought they were going to do that when I saw where they were going with it, but they really don't do that at all. And they build a very different kind of story out of it, which I don't love all the execution of, but I do like that they try to go in a different direction with it.
Definitely.
Yeah. all right, what else should we talk about in the story? I mean, there's certain characters I feel like we should probably discuss, like Sadie Adler is one who, I mean, she's the best female character Rockstar's ever written, right?
Yes, yeah, okay. The easily. I mean, like, what her competition is probably Bonnie and Abigail from Red Dead 1.
Yes, and like, I think Abigail, here's the thing. Sadie is written really well in Red Dead 2. Like, I just think she's one of the best Rockstar characters, period, regardless of gender. She does nothing to lessen my worries about Rockstar's overall ability to write women because, you know, Sadie is heavily masculinized. They're in just more of their comfort zone with how they write Sadie because she's basically becomes one of the boys. And I think Abigail is written really poorly in Red Dead 2 to me. She's like in there. It's my biggest problem with the epilogue is how much they make Abigail just the shrieking girlfriend throughout all of that. And it's so one note. The only other female character of note in the entirety of Red Dead 2 is probably, well, okay, there's the stranger you can find, the widow out in the world. And I think that's a really well-written character, but it's entirely optional. But the other one would be Arthur's ex-girlfriend, whatever her name was.
Mary.
And, my God, there's that scene with Mary. It's the last time you see her, I think, where you go on a date in Cobblestone. Is that the city? No, Cobblestone.
No, that's from Dragon Quest XI. Saint-Denis.
Saint-Denis. It's got cobblestones in it. And you go on.
Yes, as with most cities, it does,
And you go on the date with her, and that's the worst written part of Red Dead 2, where every line out of her mouth is, "Oh, Arthur. Oh, Arthur." And she does it so many times. And you really, I still feel like Rockstar utterly flails when they try to write women outside of a overtly masculinized context. But Sadie Adler is a top-notch A-plus character, and we should talk about her.
Yeah, and her development from being like a character that I kept on kind of forgetting was in the camp in the first couple of days I played the game, because she's the woman whose husband was murdered brutally by the O'Driscolls up in the mountains, and you kind of save her from them, and she kind of joins the gang. And then for those first, like, for most of chapter 2 in the camp, she's just, like, every time you talk to her, she's just like, "Fuck you guys, fuck all this shit." Like, well, you think, like, because Arthur will walk up to be like, "How you doing, ma'am?" And she's like, "Oh, how the fuck do you think I'm doing, asshole?" And that mode I kind of enjoyed. And then it's when you have that quest where you go into Rhodes and she decides, you know what, fuck it. And she goes and she just, you know, as you say, she is masculinized, but I think there's something really compelling about her just deciding to abandon, like, the very, like, severe gender roles that were confined, like, imposed upon her in 19th century, and saying, like, fuck it, I'm going to wear pants. I'm going to wear pants because I'm riding fucking horses, and I'm going to shoot motherfuckers because I'm really fucking pissed off.
Yeah, and I should be clear. I'm oversimplifying it. It's not just as simple as she's masculinized. I think there are genuinely interesting things in a gender context going on here. I just want to note that, like, If your overall trend is Rockstar is uncomfortable with writing women in even vaguely feminine contexts, nothing in Red Dead 2 changes that, I don't think.
Oh, that's true, yeah.
But I do think there is more to Sadie than just they write her like a man. There's a lot more to it, and I think she's well-written in that context. Like, have you seen the movie Hostiles that came out last year?
No.
You should. It's great. It's with Christian Bale. It's an underseen film from last year that was really, really good. And it's one of those, like, revisionist westerns that I think does some really cool stuff. And there's a character in that played by Rosamund Pike, who is basically Sadie Adler. It's the movie starts with them. It's Indians who have, like, burned her house down, not a rival gang. But they find her, and she comes along, and she kind of decides on a new life while with this company. And that character, I think, is, like, an interesting part of Hostiles, but not my favorite part of that film. this is like that character type done just to 11, just done so beautifully. And I think how I was surprised, because I can't even pinpoint the moment when she really becomes a central character, because there is that mission where you go to Rhodes and you do that with her, but then she's absent for a while after that too. But there's some point where she is just kind of omnipresent, and she's one of Arthur's confidants and a really like dear friend, not just a person in the camp and someone you rely on, and she does some really cool stuff. And then in the epilogue, she's the star of the epilogue to me.
Yeah,
she's got the best stuff in there, and I think it's such a cool natural evolution. It's just, it's great character writing.
Yeah, and she is definitely the part that makes the epilogue most worthwhile to me, is seeing Sadie Adler, like, 7 years later or whatever it is, as she's become, like, a full bounty hunter. And, yep, like, and she is, in a weird way, like, living that, like, mythicized Western life. And she has, like, the big, cool black coat that, like, trails after her on her horses. She has the cool hat. And she's just, like, you know, going around fucking Annie Oakley style and fucking shit up. And it's awesome.
Yeah, no, it's awesome. Yeah, I absolutely agree. She seems like the kind of woman that somebody wrote a couple of ballads about, you know?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, she definitely has this like very mythical quality to her at a certain point in the game, and I like, I'm so glad that they never like tried to make anything like romantic between her and Arthur, where it felt like there was a point where, once I saw that, like, okay, they're kind of pairing Arthur and her together on a couple of missions where she becomes clearly is, like, the most capable fighter in the group outside of Arthur, and maybe even more than Arthur. And then I was like, oh, are they going to, like, try to do a whole romance thing between these two characters? But they have so much restraint in not trying to go there and just make it this totally platonic relationship between, like, the two people most keeping this gang together, because they're the two people that have their shit together more than anybody else, as everyone else is falling apart.
Yeah. So Sadie's great. We talked about Dutch. We've talked at length about Arthur. Just vocal performance of the year. We should just re-underline for Arthur Morgan. Like, man, oh man. We usually give a little award about that, and he wins.
Yeah. I mean, far and away the best rock star protagonist.
Oh, God, yeah.
Easily. Like, it's... He takes them all out back and shoots them in the back of the head. Like, he's so good.
He's so great. I mean, that's honestly part of, like... Not that I think the epilogue should have somehow resurrected Arthur Morgan. They shouldn't. They did the right decision by having you play as John. But it's part of why the epilogue just doesn't grab me as much, is that John's a good character. No doubt about it. He's not Arthur Morgan. You know?
Yeah.
And when I'm riding around my horse in the world and I'm not hearing that gruff, awesome Western voice, it's not the same. Just not the same.
Oh, that's my girl.
Oh, I love it. I love it. Are there any other major characters we should break down? What are your thoughts on Micah? I do think the end of the game over-relies on Micah a little bit. I wish the last thing you do was not just a fist fight with Micah. I kind of wanted him to shut the fuck up and go away. And I also wish I could have killed him as Arthur Morgan, because he gets cartoonishly... He was already cartoonishly evil. He becomes a Saturday morning cartoon villain in the epilogue.
I mean, he's like, he is Iago. Like, yeah, he is so Shakespearean. So, like, the over-the-topness doesn't bother me in that way, because he feels like a character that is working in that kind of mythicized mode.
It's not the over-the-topness, it's the overusedness, I think, at a certain point.
I just think there's something about, because I like that it's not, at least it was not to me clear early on that, like, Micah was going to be the thing. Like, he's the antagonist of the game, and it doesn't sort of, like, solidify that way for a long time.
Yeah.
And that was something that, like, I thought was pretty impressive to me about the storytelling in the game. That it's like, he sucks from minute fucking one. Micah fucking sucks. I hate him more than I hate maybe almost any fucking character in fiction. Like, he's just such a piece of shit. But there's something so perfect about the fact that, like, like, Arthur just can't get rid of him because he's in the gang, and he is that, like, he is in many ways like the harsh reality of what it is, what like outlaws are. Like, he's the only one who's kind of honest about what this group of people are actually like and like what they are actually doing. And because he's in the group and Arthur is like abiding by this code of honor and code of rules that nobody else is abiding by, he's the only one, I mean, other than, you know, maybe John Marston doesn't and people like that, but I mean, of like the people in power, he's the only one that is like really sort of believes in that honor. Dutch doesn't really give a shit.
No.
And Micah sure as shit doesn't give a shit. And like, Micah is like very deliberately using that code as a weapon against Arthur and everybody else in the gang to elevate himself higher and higher. And so that those elements in the like the vaguely Shakespearean quality of him made me really enjoy Micah in a like I fucking hate that guy kind of way. And it was the primary force that drove me through the epilogue that I wanted to see that piece of fucking shit dead. Which is perfect because also kind of the point of the game is like, but you need to, at some point, you need to let that kind of stuff go or you perpetuate the cycle, because it is exactly John going after Micah that sets things in motion for Red Dead Redemption 1, because that's how Ross and the other FBI agents track him down to his house eventually. So
yeah, I hadn't thought of that connection, because my next question to you, Sean, was going to be about kind of some discomfort I think I felt with how much weight is put thematically on John Marston as like, and his family, as the kind of hope that Arthur sees and the hope that is kind of there in the entire epilogue of like trying to build a new life, trying to do that thing that Arthur Morgan never could. And there were definitely points where I felt like Rockstar fell victim to their own past nihilism, where they couldn't change the story of Red Dead Redemption 1. So they're tied to the story they told, which is that Arthur ultimately never got his shit together. Or not Arthur. John ultimately never got his shit together. He had to go hard back into the criminal lifestyle, and it ultimately was all for naught because he died. Abigail died apparently like a year after him of some illness or something, and then Jack went and became a criminal and started murdering people. Like, it's such a bleak ending. And so you're playing through the entire Arthur part knowing, and this is what all of his efforts are ultimately going to go to. And you play the entire epilogue where you are, you know, brick by brick building the spaces of Red Dead Redemption 1. And it is all ultimately contributing to this bleak as fuck ending. And there just was a tension there for me between a genuine glimpse of redemption that Red Dead Redemption 2 has for, like, humans on a personal level, and this, the message of Red Dead Redemption 1, which is that it is utterly and completely inescapable and there is no way out no matter what. And that is the typical Rockstar message. Up to this point, Red Dead Redemption 2, to me, feels like it breaks through that message in at least a couple of significant ways. Not everything is sunshine and roses way, but in a way of, like, there is a genuine belief in Red Dead Redemption 2 that people are capable of profound change. I think that's inescapable. That is a theme of this game. And it is bumping up to me against a game that they made before where that is not the message to me. And I see that connection there, but, like, even just the end of Red Dead Redemption 2, it's so kind of folksy and hope, you know, hopey with, like, you building your house and having the wedding and everything. And I know there is, you have the whole, in during the credits, the Agent Ross coming and finding him. But I guess I was not sure how I was meant to read that, because I think if there were a different world where Red Dead Redemption 1 did not exist, the John Marston-esque figure of this game, I don't think at the end of this story you would be meant to think in a couple of years he and his wife will be dead and his son will be a killer.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely see that. Part of how I took it is, it reminds me of the end of Husbands of River Song, to bring everything back to Doctor Who, as we must.
What are the worst episodes of Doctor Who?
No, not the wedding of River Song.
Oh, sorry.
Husbands of River Song, the Christmas special with Peter Capaldi.
Good point, sorry.
Easy mistake. The Doctor, yes, it's they're very similar titles, where the Doctor says, sort of like, this isn't a fairy tale, there is no such thing as a happily ever after, and River says, no, like, that's not what it means, it's not about happily ever after, it's just about time, little time. And that's what I feel like Red Dead Redemption 2 is saying, because because the whole game, you know that ultimately things are going to be bad, that ultimately John's going to get sucked back into the life from Ross. And, I mean, because as soon as you see Agent Ross, you see him in fucking Chapter 2, he's with the main Pinkerton dude in this game. So you, like, that stuff is hanging over it the whole time. But I think the lesson isn't that it's like, oh, it's going to end up as shit, and so therefore it's all shit. It might end up as shit. And it's like, it's not easy to get out of that cycle, but you can learn to appreciate what you have while you have it and strive to make it better while you can, because that's ultimately what Arthur's revelation is about. Isn't necessarily about achieving the happily ever after. It's about fighting for what you can get and appreciating what you can get while you have it and being able to see the beauty in the world. Because up to that point, before Arthur has tuberculosis, he can't quite see the world around him, and he can't quite see himself in some ways. And it's after he you know, has to sort of like come to Jesus moment in a certain way, he gets this perspective on things that he understands how valuable life is, how valuable people are, and happiness is, and how valuable just like the world is. And he's been taking all of that for granted. And I think that's, she certainly didn't pass all that on 100% successfully onto John Marston, but that's the kind of thing he's trying to pass on. And that's why I like that the epilogue, even if it has a shadow hanging over it, is ultimately happy. And it ends with a marriage in a, like, if we're going back to the Shakespearean stuff, it's a comedy. It ends with a marriage. It ends with, you know, the happy union of the two lovers. And so that stuff, well, I definitely agree with you. There is some tension, and it's a little bit messy in the way that prequel stuff typically is. It ultimately is really interesting to me because of the messiness and like what it is trying to explore with that messiness.
I get that. It's just, and I agree. And I think that's a great way to look at the game thematically. It just, that tension for me is between a game that feels so mature and thoughtful about all of its major themes and a game that came before it, that is set after it, that is not immature. I would not call Red Dead Redemption 1 a fully immature game at all, but a game that is not nearly as mature as this one in, I think, how it treats things and its sort of moral absolutism that it ultimately falls down on. And again, if like Red Dead Redemption 2 were its own game, I think it would come to a more nuanced way of seeing this all at the end. Then for me, it's just, I can't get the bleakness out of my head.
I think for me, I'm just such a naturally pessimistic person.
Okay.
That like, when it's like, well, of course John Marston's story ends with him dying alone violently because, like,
yeah.
But that like because everybody dies eventually and everybody's life will suck to a certain extent. But you need to be able to appreciate it along
sure.
the way.
But, you know, we only see so much of that appreciation, I guess, is what I'm saying. Yeah. But, like, you know, let me tell you, because I was going to ask you this later, when they do Red Dead Redemption 3.
Yes, when they do the sequel to the game that sold $1 billion
in a weekend, yes.
A weekend or something, yeah.
You know, what do we want out of it? Because I was thinking a lot during the last stretch that, to me, the natural thing for a Red Dead Redemption 3 is do the story of Jack Marston, the son of John Marston. And what I want, and this is where my pitch gets into, this will never happen, but this is what I want, is I want Red Dead Redemption 3 to start out in the mode where, like, you're Jack Marston, you've got your guns, you've got your horse, you're in the, like, last vestiges of the Old West. And over the course of that game, I want him to try to build a life to a point where, at a certain point, you never get to use a gun again. You're, like, working as a farmhand. It becomes, like, Gone Home or something. Like, just go full fire, the walking simulator with it, and have him, like, you know, experience the love of a good woman and become, like, that sort of thing, and, like, become a good man and, like, try to, like, actually become civilized, because encroaching civilization is such a part of these two games, but it is not one you are ever fully enmeshed with. But Jack Marston, he will live to the time of, like, John F. Kennedy if he does not get killed down. Like, he is, you know, if he was born in, like, 1890 or something, then am I wrong on that? Like, he'd be old.
Yeah,
but
he's... Yes, because this game is set in 1899, so he would have been born about 1889, 1890-ish.
So he would live to modern times, like what we think of as modern times. He will not, unless he dies young, shot in the streets, he will literally not be able to, you know, he will live through the Great Depression. Like, these things will happen. He will see history happen, you know? And I would be so fascinated for them to tell that story and have it be kind of Red Dead Redemption, but also kind of a city story where it's kind of like a proto GTA, but also kind of like just do something completely different with it. Do what like Naughty Dog has done in like The Last of Us and Uncharted 4, and just kind of go off genre at points and just do the walking sim thing and just do the like, I don't know, to have fucking fun puzzles in it. I don't care, but I would be so fascinated by that story because I'm genuinely not sure what the direction is if that's not it.
Yeah, I mean, So I think there's two obvious directions you can go. You can either set something earlier, because I mean they set Red Dead Redemption 1 in 1911.
Yeah.
So it's like they by how they set the first game, there's not much space afterwards if you want it to technically be a Western. So they would prequel with this one. You can do another prequel that I think if you went that direction, it would have to be basically unrelated to the cast
right.
of Red Dead 1 and 2, because I think it'd be... I do not want to play a game where we're, like, young Dutch or something. Like, that's not something I ever want. Or young Arthur. Like, that's not a story to be told. So you either do that and just make it, like, a Western story, but with a whole different cast of characters, which is fine. Like, we don't have many Western video games. I'm fine with getting a Western video game from Rockstar every, like, 7 years or something. Or you do what you're saying and you set it after, where I go immediately with setting it after, is that that would mean... If you're setting it, like, shortly or, like, a couple of years or so after the epilogue in Red Dead Redemption 1, that means that Jack Marston is in fucking World War One.
Okay.
Like, that's where you are. That's where you are in history. Or if you want him to be a full-blown adult, welcome to World War II. He maybe would be a little bit old to be act properly.
Well, you'd have the Great Depression in between the two, and you'd have a lot of story to tell there.
Yeah, so that's because my instinct immediately goes to you'd make it a World War One game, because once you get to the Great Depression, it's not a Western anymore. Yeah. Like, there's no like World War One is the like absolute death of the Western in terms of like American history. You would define the West in American history.
I deeply want a version of this game where they pull the rug out from under the entire audience and you play a like 10 to 15 hours of the last vestiges of the old West. And then Jack gets drafted or something, you know? And, like, make it a World War One game, and then that's Act Two, and Act Three is he comes back and has to build a life in the actual world. Like, that would be the most experimental AAA video game of all time. It will never happen, but that's the story you would have to tell if you're going to do it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm the guy who was like, oh, they finally made it so that you have to press the trigger again to cock the fucking gun in Red Dead Redemption 2. Great. Like, I'm the guy who's like, put more meters into Red Dead Redemption 2 so I really have to eat. I am all for the, like, let's just make it hardcore, weird bullshit that nobody actually wants to deal with except for me.
Yes. No, I am too, because by the end of the game, Sean, I was so on that level with you that you were talking about. I mean... I spent a lot of time fishing, and you know, it was so good. And, yeah, part of me is just, like, seeing what Rockstar did with some of the, like, gunplay and the realism in Red Dead Redemption 2, I feel like they're the only ones who have mechanically shown an aptitude to do, like, an actual World War One style shooter, you know?
Yeah.
Because I don't think they would take the Battlefield 1 isn't war fun approach.
Yeah, it's like, oh, man, look how epic this whole thing is. This isn't so epic, guys.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I basically want Red Dead Redemption 3 to be a weird, like, For Whom the Bell Tolls riff, you know?
Sure, yeah, just go full Hemingway with it. One thing we need to talk about, thinking about Red Dead Redemption 3, is how fucking ironic is it that we were all making so much fun of this game being called Red Dead Redemption 2, and it's like, why wouldn't you do, it was Red Dead Revolver, a game that nobody played. Then Red Dead Redemption. Certainly this has to be Red Dead Revolution or something like that. And then it turns out, actually no, Red Dead Redemption 1 shouldn't be called Red Dead Redemption 1 because this is the game that earns redemption.
Yes.
Like, this is a game that's actually properly about redemption. Red Dead Redemption 1 is, like, about redemption in the most vaguest sense. This is, like, this is a game that is actually about redemption, and it kind of annoys me that this is the one that has the 2 on it. This one should just be called Red Dead Redemption.
Yes, Red Dead Revolver would be a perfectly fine title for Red Dead Redemption 1.
I agree, yes. Yeah.
By the way, I was thinking of A Farewell to Arms, not For Whom the Bell Tolls, but actually both of those would be perfectly applicable to the situation. So, you know, Hemingway's got plenty of choices if you want sad World War One drama.
Exactly.
To dip into the short stories there. What's the one about the clouds that look like elephants?
Oh, Hills Like White Elephants.
Hills Like White Elephants. Yeah, just... Yes. That could be a mission.
The abortion one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That should be a mission in Red Dead Redemption 3. Hills Like White Elephants.
The fucking conversation tree stuff, it just goes to really crazy places where it's like... Man, like it's you have like 5 different options of things to say, but they're all talking around the subject.
Yes. Now I want someone to... Some indie developer. You could really get famous with that video game. Think Man, of how many think pieces would be written about that if you put that out on Steam.
Don't even make it, like, similar. Just do a, like, literal video game adaptation of Hills Like White Elephants. I just want that.
Hills Like White Elephants, the visual novel.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Okay. I think we're probably nearing the end here. It's going to be a long time until Red Dead Redemption 3, so on some level this is a futile conversation because... I mean, Grand Theft Auto is going to lap this generation, which is kind of crazy. Like, GTA 5 got a release here, but it was not originally made for this generation. It was for the previous gen. There's no fucking way GTA 6 is going to be on this generation of consoles, even if they cross-release it. I think it's going to be too late for that. So Red Dead Redemption 3 is probably a PlayStation 6 game,
being realistic. Honestly, now that I'm thinking about it, like, with the time scale, like, the human race won't be around to see a Red Dead Redemption 3.
I mean, that is a genuine question. Now that we've played it, now that we've seen the scope of this thing, it's, you know, you can't talk about this game without thinking about the labor conditions and all of that.
Right.
I think Red Dead Redemption 2 probably is too big. I think it probably is too long. I think it does not need its own largesse is not fully necessary to tell its story. And obviously, this is not a sustainable business model, even for Rockstar. If they can only get a game out every 6 years because they're of this scale, you know, I understand these games make a lot of money. They're not always going to make that much money, and that is a ridiculous amount of time to go between releases. And it also just, like, if games in general slow down to that crawl, it's not a sustainable industry at that point, right? Because as we've talked about with Assassin's Creed, if you're releasing a game the size of Assassin's Creed Odyssey every year, no one has time to play them. And it's kind of a paradox there. So, I mean, what do you make of that with Red Dead Redemption 2 and the future of this kind of game?
The important thing you're forgetting about is that Red Dead Online just came out a couple of days ago. So, like, and GTA 5 will continue to bring in probably hundreds of millions of dollars for years to come. Like, I tried out Red Dead Online, played like an hour of it, and nope, not for me. Like, I think if I was like 14 and had a bunch of friends that all that we did with our free time was play Red Dead Online, it would be something I enjoyed, which is the exact same thing I felt about GTA Online. But yeah, that seems to be Rockstar's business model, is the, like, we will make this ridiculous, massive, lavish single player campaign, work our people to death, not pay them proper wages, not even credit all the people in the game, which was something that really soured the credits of this fucking video game for me.
Yeah.
It's thinking about all that fucking horseshit. But then they're going to just print money with their online modes that are just filled with fucking microtransactions and all that kind of horseshit.
And literal horseshit.
Yes, literal horseshit. Horses shit all the time in this game. Great. Good. I've Metal Gear Solid 5 and Red Dead Redemption 2, the two best games if you're way into horses shitting. Those are the two games for you. I'm starting my new list, and we'll eventually make our way up to 10 games, and I'll be able to publish it.
Is this your new big award next to the voice actress
shit.
One?
Oh, man. Oh, no, I hadn't even thought about that. I'm going to have to
work on that. My Yuki Sawashiro award, and then your horses shitting award.
Yeah, the game if you want horses shitting. But yeah, I think it's something of where... Oh, the other thing to think about with Red Dead Redemption 2 is how painfully fucking obvious is it that the only reason the new Austin, like Red Dead Redemption 1 areas, are even in this game is just for Red Dead Online. Because they are not used for fucking anything.
I haven't really seen them. I mean, at a certain point I just needed to be done with the game, and there was part of the map that was just still blurry to me. I mean, and this is
there's
my,
nothing there.
This is my point, is it's just... Yeah, even if you go by, and you're absolutely right about everything you're saying, they could still print money with their online game if the map were 30% smaller. Like, GTA 5 is probably half the size of Red Dead Redemption 2. I mean, it's crazy. And, you know, if Rockstar's business model is we're going to pay for our esoteric cool story modes by just manipulating the fuck out of people with online modes we put kind of minimal effort into... I guess it's a very sad vision of capitalism in this day and age. I still think, like I said, it's successful for now. I don't know if it will be forever. You never know how the industry is going to evolve. But yeah, it's a weird moment. I'm very curious if Red Dead Online has the same kind of staying power that GTA Online did.
Yeah, me too. Because playing the little bit of it I did, because I never talked about this on the podcast, because why would I? But I do pretty frequently watch the Let's Play, the Achievement Hunter Let's Plays that they do in Grand Theft Auto 5, because that's how I enjoy that game now. It's like, oh, I like to watch funny people play this ridiculous fucking video game. That's the only reason I know anything about GTA Online. And playing the little bit of Red Dead Redemption Online felt like, you know, like, I can kind of see material in this, and maybe there's just stuff that, like, you get in deeper and there's, like, more kind of wacky shit that goes on. but it doesn't feel like it has the potential of, like, what makes GTA Online such an interesting game to watch be played is that you have fucking airplanes and jet bikes and dudes with homing rocket launchers and fucking tanks and a big fucking disco dancing truck all coming together and people in, like, fucking dropping nuclear orbit strikes on shit. Like, it's a game that has, because of its more modern setting, its more ridiculous tone, it has all this just crazy shit in it. And in Red Dead, I just, you know, you have horses, and horses are fucking awesome. I love my horse to death. It was the saddest thing in this game when the horse dies, yes, and Arthur goes up to it and whispers in his ear, thank you. But it's not as much fun to watch a bunch of people ride horses as it is to watch people crash into walls at like 500 miles per hour in a ridiculous future sports car.
I mean, keep in mind, GTA Online was horrible when it launched, and like everyone acknowledged, it was like it was broken and it was shitty and you couldn't do anything in it, so... Who knows? It'll depend on if they put in the effort. I think Rockstar has put in the effort with GTA Online, in part because they are bathing in money just every day, just rubbing it in every orifice from GTA Online. Gross. I know. But just, you know, it's true. And I don't know if Red Dead 2 Online will have that effect, because as you say, I guess you could give the horse a jetpack. I just don't know what that looks like.
I just feel like Red Dead's not built to support that. Red Dead is built to support this, like, much smaller scale, more intimate experience. Whereas, like, GTA was already built with, like, where you could fly fucking planes. And so the scale of things is so different.
Okay, another question.
Yeah.
The head exploding animations in this game from shotguns are so glorious and amazing. It has me convinced there will be a zombie mode in Red Dead 2 in the future. Do you think they will do Undead Nightmare 2 as a solo, you know, single-player expansion, a la Undead Nightmare 1, or is that just going to be a multiplayer mode somewhere down the line, where Undead Nightmare is now a zombies-esque mode, a la Call of Duty?
I mean, I so desperately want an Undead Nightmare 2 that is what you're describing. And
with Arthur Morgan versus zombies?
Oh, yes, and just the fucking, again, I said it the last time we talked about Red Dead, I will emphasize it again, and it will come up in our Game of the Year awards, the pump-action shotgun in Red Dead Redemption 2 is the best shotgun ever in a video game, and there is no better, more pure thing to do with a shotgun than to blow up a zombie's head with it. And so there should be an Undead Nightmare 2. If there is any justice in this world, we would get a proper single player Undead Nightmare 2. But of course, we live in a stinking shithole where there is no such thing as justice, and all nihilism and cynicism prevails. And so, yes, of course we will get the terrible fucking zombies half-ass mode that they put in that nobody even really likes, and they call it Undead Nightmare, and it comes out around Halloween, and everyone forgets that it exists. That is 100% actually what's going to happen with this game.
I'm just
going to
clip this part for next October when we do an I Told You So segment, when that gets announced. Yeah, I mean, of course that's going to happen. How are they going to add a Battle Royale mode to the game?
I'm surprised that there isn't one in it right now. Yeah. I'm legitimately shocked that was not something that they had ready. Right.
So, Sean, I'm going to end this by turning away from Red Dead 2 for a second and tying together several themes of this podcast, which is really just, we said the words Battle Royale, and we talked a lot about Dragon Ball on this podcast. And, Sean, I want to pitch you on something that I'm surprised is not a video game yet.
Okay, go ahead.
I mean, I know how. We only just got Dragon Ball Fighters. We can only get one Dragon Ball game at a time. What is the likelihood that someone in the world, probably in Japan, has been tasked with working on a Dragon Ball Battle Royale fighting game a la the Universe Survival Arc called, like, Dragon Ball Tournament of Power, where you're on a big map and it's like Xenoverse-style 3D and you get 80 fucking people on the map in teams and you fight? That sounds like it probably actually wouldn't be good, but it's something someone should absolutely try to make, because if it was, it would be amazing. And it's like, it's a built-in genre. It was a hot arc on Dragon Ball Super. They've got to be doing that, right?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, the major thing I need to point out is, of course, that every Battle Royale game is a shooter and not a fighting
game.
Yes,
but...
And thus, like, the primary gameplay mechanics are completely different between the two.
Yeah, but it's built for it. It's a giant fucking circle that you drop a bunch of people onto, and they fight under a time limit. I don't quite know how it works, but that's not my job. I'm just the ideas guy.
I mean, that's pretty good. But try this one on for size, okay, Jonathan, to tie something different together. What if it was sort of like that? It was a Battle Royale thing, But instead of like 100 Gokus parachuting onto a weird magic stage in the world of Void, what if it was 100 Agent 47s parachuting onto an island and they all have to assassinate each other while they're making their way to the middle? Wouldn't that be a good game?